Okay. I'd like to call the Osiris Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council meeting to order. Note for the record, we do have a quorum present. Members, you should have before you the agenda for this morning. Note that the meeting runs until about noon, and we will call the lead of staff because I know that we need to board a bus shortly after noon to get on our way for the field tour. Members, if you look at the agenda, you'll see there are a number of decision items. We need to approve the administrative budget of the council. We're going to have a presentation by Jim Nobles and John Yonker for the Office of the Legislative Auditor on the Natural Resources Land Report that was just completed by their office. Judy Grew from Management Analysis is here to give us another update on the 25-year framework. Al Sullivan and Bob Sonnenberg from the Minnesota Forest Resources Council and Minnesota Forest Resources Partnership are going to give us a brief update about some of their work to help us out in the 25-year framework. And then a very important part of our agenda is the accomplishment plan approvals that you were all hopefully sent last week and had a chance to look over carefully. Members, that's the agenda we have for the morning. Are there any additions, deletions, corrections to the agenda as drafted? If not, I'd entertain a motion to approve. Motion to approve the agenda as drafted. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion adopted. Next item is the executive director's report. Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been a busy couple of weeks since our last meeting, mostly getting ready for this meeting and traveling throughout the state to represent the council. I was up in Baudette to meet with the Lake of the Woods School District who had before us and before the Conservation Partners Grants Program and a school forest restoration program to discuss with them how to improve their application. In the course of those discussions, there was some disconcerting news about the way that they were ranked in the DNR kind of Conservation Partner Grant Application Project or program. And to make a long story short, they were rejected because of a lack of one form that wasn't really clear that they needed to turn in. And subsequently talking with DNR, a number of people didn't understand that they were supposed to turn that form in. So we're doing some corrective work in the DNR program to make sure it's clear about exactly what has to be turned in to make the applications qualifying. And in the course of that, discuss with them the possibility of putting together a school forest restoration program to come for the council. I don't know whether we'll see it or not, but we'll take care of it if it comes our way. Also was asked by the Northern Counties Land Use Coordinating Board to come up and talk to them about the history and past recommendations and relationships with the counties and that sort of thing. And they were very curious about Northern County membership on the council and wondered how they could affect future appointments. We had a two-hour conversation, which was pretty in-depth. And they were quite curious about our attitude toward local support of projects. And then I had a meeting in Duluth with a landowner who owns 30,000 acres of forest in Lake County. And I met with the landowner, his legal staff, and the county and their legal staff. And the county was interested in whether or not they could apply for the funds to purchase the private land and forest land and proceed with consolidation and addressing checkerboard land ownership patterns. We may see something there from the county. This 30,000 acres of land is also in the Forest Legacy Program, so you may be presented with a choice as to whether to buy in fee or do an easement, which will be an interesting, I think, discussion to have. Upcoming, there are two meetings that Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer a member the opportunity to join me if they want to. One is the Red River Basin Flood Damage Reduction Work Group, June 23rd. As you may remember, they issued us an invitation earlier, and they want to sit down and talk a little bit about the benefits of flood damage reduction. I'm on their agenda for a half an hour, and it's June 23rd in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. And then on June the 28th in Bemidji, the Joint Powers Natural Resource Board is requesting that we attend. And they want us to review the application process and discuss possible programs to apply for. And we need to highlight the Conservation Partners Program. And they've requested that a member join us in the discussion. So you would authorize a member to travel to each of those. If you as members want to come, contact Sandy and me, and we'll get it started.
In fact, on that point, I will. So if a member, I can authorize one member for each of the meetings, each of the two meetings. So if there's someone who's interested in attending that, either of the two meetings with Bill, please let Bill know, and we'll certainly cover your cost for that meeting.
On other business, we discovered yesterday that we had the wrong sheet attached to one of the projects, and in your package you'll find a three-hole punch sheet that is titled Minnesota Prairie Recovery Project. That should be placed in your binder next to the accomplishment plan for that program. And with that, that's the executive director's report as I have.
Questions for Bill?
Yeah. No, Bill, which number is it here?
2F.
So the last page of 2F, the map on the one side, the acreage and the parcel information on the back, cross that out, and that's your new parcel information. Other questions for Bill? Bill, I have a question. When you met with the school forest people up in Baudette, and they said they were rejected from the Conservation Partners Program, could you give me a little more detail about why they were rejected? I wasn't following exactly what the... I guess, the first of all, more detail about why they were rejected, and number two, was that a widespread occurrence, or have you heard from any other potential applicant who was rejected for that particular reason?
They were rejected because they did not submit a form called the land manager's form. There was some confusion because they were the land manager. The land manager's form was to indicate that the land manager was on board with the project. And it wasn't clear that if you owned the land, you had to submit it. I don't know how many people were rejected by this. I'm talking to Leslie Tannehill. She just simply commented there were others who had the same problem. And I asked her if they were resolving the issue, and she said, yes, they're resolving the issue. But that's what I know about the situation.
And just to follow up on that, so that they were just told you're out as opposed to you're missing this, you need to put this piece of information together to get back into the system.
They called to see what, to make sure that their proposal had been received, discovered that it had been received and rejected. This was the day of the deadline. And immediately got the form filled out and had somebody come deliver it. DNR, and DNR wouldn't accept it because of the grant rules, which is...
Jim?
I have a question, Bill, on that 30,000 acres. So, I mean, we've heard a lot of comments that they want more public land up in that part of the country, but they have the support of the county on this acquisition.
The self-proclaimed county board member most in opposition to expanded public land was at the meeting, and he understands that if the project were funded, there must be, at the end of all exchanges and things like that, 30,000 additional acres of habitat in Lake County at a minimum, could be more, valued at the amount of their appropriation or more. So that's a way of saying the most conservative county board member understands what the rules are. They have yet to submit a request.
Any other questions for Bill? Scott, I know that you're long distance today, but don't hesitate to speak up. Any questions for Bill?
No, sir.
Okay, great. All right. Thank you, Bill. The next item on the agenda, members, is the administrative budget. And note this is an action item. So, Bill, could you explain the item and the paperwork that goes with this?
You will find in your packet a budget that is titled LSOHC FY 2011 Administrative Budget. This is the distribution of the appropriation received in the 10 legislative session for the council. The majority of the expense is in personnel. Meeting expenses are the next largest grouping, followed by office expenses at $43,500. This is as we testified in the hearings on our recommendations.
Questions for Bill on the administrative budget. So this note, this is an item to approve that will then set this administrative budget for the council for the next year starting July 1. Bill, a question for you. I mean, I've been around the office enough to know that you guys are just running as fast as you can to keep up. You have $220,000 budgeted for full-time staff. If, in fact, mid-year or sometime during this next fiscal year, you're at that point where you need to add an additional staff person because of the growing program complexity with, you know, now 2 years under our belt and a number of accomplishment plans and reports and so forth, is there enough money in the budget to be able to do that, let's say, mid-year?
Not in the appropriation we received in fiscal year 11. We do have a carry forward from fiscal year 10 that amounts to $251,000 that could be used to hire new staff. What I'm doing right now is trying to judge how much the duties of the staff are growing as we add appropriation years. We started out with 19 projects. They are active for 3 years. We've got another 20-some-odd projects. Some of those are active for 5 years. So in 2 years, we've got 40 projects. We'll soon, sooner than later, within the next year, have another 20, I hope, and that would be 60. So I'm trying to judge what the workload actually is going to be, and it's complicated somewhat by this 25-year planning. So keep that in mind. And I think that this is a discussion that the council needs to have at the right time. And it has to be a council decision to add staff. So we're watching it.
Jim?
In statute, what were we allowed to have in administrative expenses with a 1%?
1% of the funds appropriated from the fund.
So this year we could have?
It's 59 and 18, or 16 is 75. $750,000.
And so why have we decided to cut everything so close here, though? Well, I mean, 1% is pretty minimal figure in itself.
Because I think we can do it with this amount, knowing that we have carry forward in case of emergency and need to fill additional staff. I want to also point out that in some respects, I consider the MMB MAD staff to be adjunct staff of the council at this current time. So
I think, Phil, you should point out that they are in at the bottom, and you didn't mention that, 145 for...
That's right.
Consultant.
Which we discussed at the last meeting, it was 145.
Which is a kind of a worst-case scenario from based
that's
on their
part budget. Of the 600, just to make sure it's clear. That
I've got Bill, and then back to Jim. Bill?
Yeah, just Bill. And I understand this is going to take some time to figure out, but my understanding, most of the projects are for 3 years that they'd be dropping off at the end. So that's kind of what you're looking at. So the projects we did our first year now will need to be accomplished. Is that fair to say that some of them are dropping off as we're adding 20 a year? Eventually you're going to get into a cycle where 20 add, 20 gone? Or no, am I wrong?
You should stabilize eventually. That's exactly what we're looking for, to figure out where it stabilizes. There's some complexity to what you're saying. The first year's appropriations, they were all good more or less for 3 years. The second year's appropriations, some of them are extended with their restoration project to 5 years. So
there's some complexity there.
Yeah, but I think if we just monitor it and make sure that you all know the situation we're in, you know, the worst thing that could possibly happen to this council, as far as the administration is concerned, is for us to burn out. And we just can't have that happen. And we're watching it and do what's necessary to keep it from happening.
Jim? Bill, do we know what the LCCMR spends on administrative, what their administrative budget is?
I don't know the answer to that question. I can get it for you. It's public knowledge.
Lisa?
Mr. Chair, Bill, how many full-time staff do you have in the office? That's a real new question.
Three.
This is it.
This is it.
You're looking at it. Yep.
They're amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
They are.
That's
amazing.
What I thought. I just wanted to point that out.
I think just to give some context to this, that we're facing a $5 to $6 billion shortfall in the next biennium, and you will find a great reluctance, at least in the House, on any expansion of staff. There are cuts that are occurring throughout state government, and even more cuts occurring. So adding staff in a time when there's budget cuts is not going to be looked on favorably by many members of the legislature.
Other comments? Seeing none, we need a motion to adopt the administrative budget.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
We have a motion on the floor to adopt the administrative budget as proposed. Any further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Administrative budget is adopted. Thank you, Bill, and staff for putting that together. Members, Bill, I guess I'll turn it to you to introduce the next agenda item.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
One quick question. Off of what Jim was asking with LCCMR, do you know the amount of staff they have? Maybe you could also point that out for us.
We will do that.
Thank you.
Council members, we are pleased to have before us the legislative auditor, Jim Nobles, and his staff, John Yunker, who are responsible for the evaluation report on natural resource land, which I think is, from the conservation perspective, one of the most important reports I've seen since I've been in state government for 25 years. It's a comprehensive look at DNR and to some degree Bowser programs in terms of the effects and costs associated with natural resource land at the state level in Minnesota. And with that introduction, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Becker, thank you for your introduction and members of the council. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor for the state of Minnesota. With me at the table is John Yunker, who was the project manager for this evaluation. I appeared before you some time ago to kind of give members an introduction to the Office of the Legislative Auditor, so I don't need to repeat that. And some of you obviously know us very well as legislators, and we work with you very closely. But Let me just highlight a couple of key points just to remind you, again, of who we are and what we do. We are the auditor of Minnesota state government. That's often confusing to people because, as you know, we have a state auditor that's elected. But back in the 1970s, the legislature split the jurisdiction for auditing between the two offices, created the Office of the Legislative Auditor first, and then split the jurisdiction. The state auditor audits local units of government. The state auditor has responsibility for school districts, counties, cities, and all those various units of local government. The legislative auditor has responsibility for all of state government. And so we audit state agencies, we audit the judicial branch, we audit the state's financial statements. And we can follow public money into any organization. So we also, from time to time, actually do audit work that gets into private nonprofit organizations that are using state money. And I say that because you well know that you are utilizing nonprofits a great deal in the expenditure of your funds and the administration of your grants. And with that jurisdiction, of course, comes our responsibility to audit the money that you deal with and the projects that you recommend to the legislature to appropriate money for. And just, again, to remind you, we were mandated by the legislature to audit projects, expenditures from the Outdoor Heritage Fund every 2 years. And we will start doing those audits next year. As you know, there are four funds within the Legacy Amendment, and it is a significant new responsibility for us, not only because of the amount of money involved, the scope of the projects involved, but also because of the sensitivity of this money. All public money is obviously important and has to meet a high level of accountability. But we certainly understand that a lot of people are watching this money in particular, and so we take that responsibility to do that audit work very seriously, and we are starting to put together our strategic plan for doing that. We hope to be able to audit the other funds every other year, and so we hope to get onto a cycle next year that we would be auditing two of the funds every other year. And again, we would like to start the Outdoor Heritage Fund in 2011. So just stay tuned for that. But again, that's a big piece of the Office of the Legislative Auditor, just the traditional financial audit work that you are quite familiar with. In addition, the Office of the Legislative Auditor has a program evaluation division, fairly small, about 12, 13 people. And every year we go through a process with the Legislative Audit Commission of asking legislators what topics they are concerned about, interested in, and we get a lot of requests for us to do evaluations, typically 50 or 60, and there's a subcommittee. Representative Hansen is the chair of that subcommittee, has been chair of the Legislative Audit Commission several times, as I recall, and so is very active in that process. So we get a lot of requests from legislators, and they represent interests, concerns. And the idea is that they want somebody to take a fresh, outside, independent, nonpartisan, professional look at these programs. And when we were going through that cycle in 2009, this topic, natural resource land, was on the list, came through the process, and ended up as one of the finalists that we worked on. And I think from just the short previous conversation that you had about a potential land acquisition, you know, and you know from a lot of other experiences and reasons why this topic ended up on our list to evaluate. It's very complicated and it's very controversial. There are people who think the state has too much land, and they may have that view from a philosophical, from an ideological point of view, just wanting to limit the size and scope of government. I think that's a very legitimate point of view. We understand that well. Other people, I think, have a concern about the amount of land the state owns from a more practical point of view. Can the state really manage all of the land that it has? And it was that question that we really addressed more than any other. The policy question will leave to elected officials and will leave to you to make recommendations to them on what that level of acquisition might be. But our principal focus was just to see, first of all, how much land is there within the state's domain. That sometimes is a point of confusion or controversy itself. So just getting the facts of where that land is, how much there is, what kind of land it is, how the state acquired it or obtained it. That's part of this evaluation, and Mr. Yunker is going to cover that with you as well. Another piece that Mr. Yunker is going to talk about, and I will warn you from my past experience, it gets fairly technical, but I think it's an important piece, and that's the payment in lieu of taxes, the PILT piece. Also a matter of controversy, particularly for those counties that have a lot of public land, mostly up in the northern part of the state. They are very concerned about losing tax revenue when land goes into the public domain. So they focus a lot on PILT, and we did some analysis of that. It's not easy to do, but I think Mr. Yunker and the team that we had did a good job, and I hope that the results of that assessment will be helpful to the legislature and to you to better understand some of the complexities of PILT. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Yunker, if I could. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Scott.
Can you have the presenter speak up just a little? I can just barely hear him.
Great. Thank you. Thanks, Scott.
Mr. Chairman and members of the council, I'm going to talk a little bit about what issues we looked at. Mr. Noble's covered some of that, and I'm going to tell you what our key findings were, give you a little background on natural resource land, and then talk about each one of the findings in more detail. As Mr. Nobles mentioned, we did look at DNR's land holdings. And, you know, one of the issues that we were being asked by some legislators was, do we own too much land? Should we own more land? Where should we come out on that state? And, you know, we steered clear of that issue because I think that really is a policy issue. And so what we did look at in terms of that was to look at how DNR has reviewed its existing land holdings, realizing, of course, that DNR is both acquiring land and at times selling or exchanging land. And we were really focusing on whether or not DNR was doing a good job of identifying surplus land that no longer served or did not serve much of a conservation purpose and could be sold, and whether they were looking for opportunities to exchange land with other parties where that made sense. We also looked at the management of easements by both DNR and by the Board of Water and Soil Resources. A third issue, and a very important one, was to look at the adequacy of resources that DNR had to manage and maintain their existing land holdings and easements. And in particular there, our concern is, does DNR have adequate resources to maintain the land holdings in the same condition or in good condition over time? Or are we do we have land that we are letting deteriorate in terms of its conservation values? And finally, as Mr. Nobles indicated, we looked at the adequacy of payments in lieu of taxes, a very difficult subject to get at in part because the laws do not provide much guidance about what the purpose of those payments are. In short, our findings were that DNR has made efforts to strategically evaluate its land holdings, but we felt that more work is needed, and I'll get into that in a little bit. Secondly, we felt that DNR lacked a comprehensive easement management program, but was in the process of developing one. Bowser, on the other hand, we felt had a comprehensive easement management for inventorying what its easements were, determining whether or not there was compliance with those easements, whether or not the landowners were continuing to maintain those properties in a way that was consistent with the easement agreement and which provided the conservation values that the easement agreement was there to protect. Thirdly, we felt that DNR appeared to lack adequate resources to manage and maintain its natural resource land. And finally, we said, as I alluded to briefly, the adequacy of PILT is difficult to assess. And that's primarily because it's hard to determine what the purpose of those PILT payments are and to have some criteria for judging whether the PILT payments are more or less than what they should be. It's a very subjective issue. We did feel, however, that it was important to report that it seemed like counties were receiving more than was necessary to offset lost property tax revenue when land was being acquired, for non-hunting land was being acquired. And so this is a very particular type of land and a very particular finding. It doesn't apply, does not apply to all PILT that's being paid. So I wouldn't want anybody to misinterpret what we're saying here. A little bit of background about natural resource land. There are 8.4 million acres, or about one-sixth of the state, that would be considered natural resource land that the state owns. About two-thirds of that.
Can I just ask, does that include easements, or is that just fee?
This is land that is owned by the state outright. Not does not include easements. There are some numbers out there about easements, but they're a little less definitive. So this does not include easements. It's only land owned by the state outright. It's about one-sixth of the state, two-thirds of which is managed by DNR, and that's what you consider DNR land. And another third of that is the tax forfeited land that's owned by the state and held in trust for local governments and is managed by counties. And that land is primarily forested land. This chart looks only at the DNR land. Here you can see that roughly two-thirds of the land is state forest or other forested land. About 23% or close to a quarter of it is wild management, wildlife management areas or other wildlife areas managed by DNR. And about 4% is parks and recreation areas, 3% scientific and natural areas, and that pretty much accounts for most of the acreage. It's important to recognize that of all this land that DNR manages and is owned by the state, 45% of this is school trust fund land. This is land that was given to the state back in the 19th century primarily by the federal government. And so that land has a particular purpose for which it's supposed to be managed, and it's important to recognize that. 28% or a little more than a quarter of the land is consolidated conservation land. That's land that it exists in only seven counties in the state. It's tax-forfeited land that the state acquired back in the 1920s and 1930s. Counties had, this is land that was not serving a particularly useful purpose back then. Counties were trying to rehabilitate that land. They issued bonds to drain the land and to make them suitable for agriculture or other purposes. That did not work. We were also headed for the Depression, and counties were going to default on the bonds. A couple counties were in danger of bankruptcy. And so in return for taking over the bond payments, the state acquired ownership of the land. The state continues to pay some of the, there are some proceeds from this land in terms of how it's managed. And the state shares those payments, according to state law, with the local jurisdictions involved. If you look at the trends in state-owned land, and let's focus first just on the DNR land, that land has grown fairly modestly over the last 20 years. There's been about a 5% total growth over that period in the acres of DNR land. Most of that growth has been in wildlife management areas, scientific and natural areas, and parks. Probably some small reduction. I say probably because the numbers aren't definitive, but it looks like a small reduction in the amount of forested area. If you look at the tax forfeited land, that's changed very little over the last 20 years. So fairly stable situation with some slight growth over the last 20 years. There are, of course, plans out there that DNR or advocacy groups have to acquire a significant amount of land. And many of these plans show a very significant increase projected for the future, whether it be over a 20 or 30 or 50-year period, in the amount of acquisition. Whether that acquisition can occur, of course, depends on funding, whether it be through the constitutionally dedicated funds or through the Environment and Natural Resources Fund, the general fund, whatever funding sources, that will determine how much money is available for acquisition. Obviously, there are pressures on DNR to both buy land and acquire easements. There are very good reasons to buy land and acquire easements, but there also have been some pressures on DNR to sell land. In 2003 and 2005, when we had also some budget problems in the state, the legislature passed legislation requiring the state to sell land that was surplus, and DNR has sold some land in that respect. The state is still trying to meet the goal that was set in 2005, which has still not been achieved in terms of selling land, and DNR has about, I think it's about $8.5 million of land out there and available for sale that's not been purchased yet. So in terms of evaluating performance here, on the first finding, we said that, I said earlier that DNR has done some things to reevaluate its land holdings, but we felt more work was needed. Some of the things they've done, they've identified land for sale and put it up for sale. And these are primarily lands that are considered surplus or don't serve a significant conservation value anymore. They've also been conducting a pilot project with Roseau County to kind of reevaluate DNR's land holdings in that county and look at opportunities to buy, sell, exchange land, to make some adjustments in its land holdings. And that project is still underway, and it has not been completed. And another thing that DNR has been doing has been to develop forestry plans that look at opportunities and needs to acquire land, to sell land, to exchange land. So they've been doing these plans, although they've developed those plans largely internally without a lot of input or feedback from other parties like counties or other interested groups. As I mentioned, we feel that the work is not complete, that there's still land out there, although DNR has it up for sale. We also think that there's a checkerboard pattern of public forest ownership that exists in the state and has for quite some time. You can have a big block of DNR land with a small amount of acreage in the middle of that land that's owned by some other party. It could, in fact, be state tax forfeited land that's managed by the county. And then you can have a big block of county land, county managed land, with a little parcels of DNR land in that big block. And, you know, while the situation is manageable, it isn't exactly an efficient use of resources to have those little parcels interspersed in those bigger parcels of land. So for management purposes, it would be much more efficient if we didn't have that checkerboard pattern. There might be reasons sometimes for that pattern to exist, so I think you have to leave that possibility open, but we think there are opportunities here to exchange land and to adjust land holdings that are worth considering. There's also been a long-standing issue with school trust fund land, particularly in the BWCA, where that trust fund land has been producing little revenue for the school trust fund. That's not an issue that DNR alone can tackle. It's one that has to be tackled at the federal level as well as involving state policymakers, but it's one that's worth pursuing. And as we visited a number of counties throughout the state, particularly in northern Minnesota, where there is significant land ownership by the state, there certainly is interest among those counties in having other pilot projects with DNR, like the one that's in Roseau County. They would like to have DNR come in and talk with them and discuss with them and see if there are not opportunities for exchanging land and for identifying surplus land or perhaps identifying where there's a need to acquire more land. I mentioned that we looked at conservation easement management. Conservation easements preserve land, provide conservation values by limiting certain development or other rights to the private landowner. But it's not something that the state can do, sign an easement agreement and simply walk away and assume everything is going to happen the way they would like to. It's necessary for state agencies who have easement agreements to do some initial as well as some ongoing management in order to protect the public investment in those easements. And that means maintaining an inventory of easements, doing baseline reports as to what the condition of the property is when the easement is purchased, and then doing periodic monitoring and enforcement to make sure that the landowner does not change the way the property is being managed in a way that violates the easement agreement. What we found was that the Board of Water and Soil Resources has a comprehensive program. They do have an inventory of their easements. They do monitor and enforce problems with those easements to the extent that they exist. But DNR has not had an agency-wide program. It has managed some easements better than others. Certainly, I think with some of the newer programs like Forest Legacy, they've done a better job. With older programs, maybe conservation easement management wasn't as big an issue or as much discussed back 20, 30 years ago, and so those programs were not managed as well, and they didn't have the constant monitoring or periodic monitoring as well as baseline reports. And so DNR right now has been developing a comprehensive program. They got a grant that was recommended by the LCCMR and approved by the legislature. They're in the process of compiling an inventory and developing policies for baseline reports and monitoring. So hopefully that money will be put to good use and DNR will be able to develop good policies and programs that address easement management. The third area that we looked at was funding for managing and maintaining existing DNR lands. And as I said before, it appears that DNR lacks adequate resources to do this. The deficiencies that are readily apparent are that there is initial development work that has not been done on lands that have been acquired. There's deferred rehabilitation work. There's inadequate funding for periodic maintenance or operations. We felt that it was not possible during, I'm going to give you some examples of these things, but we felt that it was not possible for us in the time we had to try to quantify the overall extent of the shortfalls, that additional study was needed, and certainly DNR itself needed to do a lot more work in this area. Some of the examples of funding issues are a backlog of development and maintenance work with respect to scientific and natural areas. For wildlife management areas, DNR really needs some kind of a management information system that tells them what the condition of wildlife management areas are and what kind of periodic activities are needed to maintain those wildlife management areas so the habitat is maintained in good condition over time, as well as an information system that allows them to estimate what is needed to do those activities to keep the wildlife management areas in good condition. So really, DNR here needs to do more work than they need to do probably in other areas. There are also some deficiencies in other areas, in parks and trails, with buildings and roads and trails themselves, maintenance that needs to be done, deferred rehab that hasn't been done. And I'll just go down to the bottom of the list. We talked about easements. there's probably going to be a need for additional resources for DNR to manage those easements that it hasn't been doing as good a job on as it should. What we recommended in the report was that DNR should prepare long-range budget analyses that compare ongoing funding needs to existing funding levels. We felt that after these analyses are prepared, that the legislature should review those analyses and how DNR has defined its needs, and that then there could be a discussion about what the right amount is. The legislature did require in this last session that DNR prepare long-range budget analyses in a number of different areas. They did it in pretty much all the different areas of land management except for parks and trails, and the reason for that is that the legislature had previously done that in the previous session, had required DNR to do that, and in, I think, last November or so, DNR presented that report to some legislative committees, and it certainly highlighted the need for additional funds for parks and trails to keep those properties and lands in adequate condition. We felt that these kinds of budget analyses will help the legislature better understand the ongoing costs of land ownership and would help the legislature balance funding for acquisitions with funding for ongoing management and maintenance.
Bill, a question?
Yes, sure. Thank you. When you're saying that there's inadequate resources to manage the DNR lands, are you working off of a plan for those particular parcels of property at all times when you do that? Or how do you come to that determination that a 1,500-acre piece in Nolan County is not being managed properly?
Ms. Counter?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ingebrigtsen, without those kinds of plans, and in some cases we don't have plans, for example, for a number of the wildlife management areas, it is difficult to say what the right amount of resources is. And that's part of the reason what we recommended was DNR needs to do this kind of work. They need to do the long-range budget analyses, and they may have to do more work in the wildlife management area because, for precisely that reason, they don't have plans, they don't have the management information system. But we also felt that there were enough indications that there were not adequate resources. We received a little bit of resistance on this from the commissioner of DNR, not necessarily from DNR itself, but from the commissioner. And I think the response to that is simply that, DNR is the one being asked to do this work. Do the work, look at it yourself, present the results to the legislature, have a public discussion about it, have it out there so that it can be taken a look at, and we can have additional public discussion about it, and that we felt was the right way to go. The last topic that we covered was payments in lieu of taxes. There were about $22 million in PILT that was paid in 2009. It's mostly distributed to counties and townships, but there is one exception. When the law was passed in 1979 to kind of change PILT, they did not change an older law that had distributed PILT for hunting, acquired hunting lands. And that law called for the PILT to be distributed to counties, townships, and school districts. So there's that one big exception in there as to who gets the PILT. There are a couple other smaller ones that I won't get into. Payment rates for PILT vary significantly depending on what kind of land we're talking about, and probably appropriately so. The payment rates are highest for acquired DNR lands, lands that were on the tax rolls when acquired. Let me just clarify. The acquired lands are lands that were on the tax rolls when acquired, or there are certain CONCON lands, these consolidated conservation lands that I talked about. If they're in state parks or state recreation areas, scientific and natural areas, or wildlife and management areas, the legislature has passed a law that kind of deems that these are acquired lands and they'll receive the high payment rates. The payment rates for acquired land are, for a county, it's either the greater of $5.11 per acre or 0.75% of the value of the property. For other DNR land, other DNR-administered state land, the payment is significantly less. It's 64 cents per acre. And for county tax forfeited land, it's $1.28 per acre. Now, those rates are a lot lower, but keep in mind that a lot of that other DNR state land is school trust fund land. It's land that was never on the tax rolls. You're not necessarily trying to replace tax revenues that were once earned on the property. And so perhaps those payments are there for another purpose. And I'll get into that in a minute. A lot of the attention on PILT has come because in the last decade, since 2000, PILT has tripled. And the amount of PILT has tripled. So it's gotten some legislative attention. Most of that change has occurred because the legislature has made some changes to PILT, and also land values have grown significantly. And because of that, and because acquired land gets some PILT based on, and can get PILT based on, percent of land values, the amount of PILT has grown a lot. But if you look at the longer history of PILT, PILT did not keep up with inflation between 1980 and 2000. That's primarily because the PILT rates were kind of fixed. They didn't adjust with inflation. They weren't based on land values. And so their real value declined over time. If you look at that entire period from 1980 through last year, 2009, the PILT paid out per acre, though, has gone up about 30% when you compare it with the 1980 PILT adjusted for inflation. So there has been some growth, primarily because of that very significant growth during the last 9 or 10 years. Having said that, though, this is not necessarily true for some counties. If you have a county that primarily has that other DNR-administered land that gets 64 cents per acre, or it has the tax-forfeited land, those values have not kept up with inflation over that longer period. And so for some counties, they'd be right in saying that their PILT has not kept up with inflation over that 29 or 30 year period. They just don't have a lot of acquired land. I mentioned that it was very difficult to assess whether PILT is adequate or not, and that's primarily because state law does not provide much guidance on the purpose of PILT. I think you could probably assume that PILT is out there to try to offset the fiscal impacts of state land ownership on local governments, but there's no guidance in state law as to what that is or what would be the right amount. And so it was very difficult for us to come to some judgment about whether the PILT that's being paid is correct or not. Some of those potential fiscal impacts are lost property tax revenue on acquired land, and I kind of alluded to that earlier. But for land that never was on the tax roll, probably the reason, if you go down to the third item on the list, probably the reason why we pay PILT is because we're trying to compensate local governments for some government services that they do provide to that land, whether that be law enforcement services, could be emergency services, roads and streets, streets and highways, there could be a number of different services that are provided by local governments that PILT is roughly trying to compensate for. And there are a number of other ways that we talk about in the report that, that PILT can either positively or negatively impact the finances of local governments. Certainly it can have some economic impacts as well, either through increased tourism, or I think some folks in southwestern Minnesota might say you're taking land, when you buy state land, you're taking land off the tax rolls and you're reducing the agriculture economy in the area. So there might be some negative effects, potentially. I'm not going to get into this too much. Suffice it to say that there are some real difficulties in trying to assess the adequacy of PILT. There's a lack of data and other ways of trying to assess how PILT affects local government costs and local government's finances. I did mention that we do in this report look at the lost property tax revenues and compare them to the PILT. And focus here is on acquired land. And in the report, we talk about acquired non-hunting land. And I'll just mention a little bit of analysis I also did on subsequent to the report being released on hunting land, because it is different. And it's different because PILT is paid to school districts when we're talking about hunting land, and it's not when we're talking about non-hunting acquired land. The comparison we did showed that PILT for newly acquired lands is on average 64% higher than the county town taxes that were being paid previously. Now, the comparison here is to counties and towns, because PILT for non-hunting land is only paid to counties and townships and not school districts. And keep in mind, this is acquired, and it's acquired non-hunting land. It's an average. It's an average within each county, and it's an average across the state. So it doesn't necessarily represent each and every jurisdiction within the state or each and every county. They vary. State land, this number can vary over time, too, because state land is reappraised once every 5 years, whereas private land is reappraised potentially every year. So if land values are going up over a five-year period after the acquisition of the state land, then that that difference between PILT and what the taxes would have been on the land if it had still been private would tend to be less than the 64% would be reduced. If land values are declining, that gap would widen, and it'd be more than 64% until the next reappraisal. Counties and towns receive this PILT for acquired non-hunting land, and so we kind of took a rough look at who's the beneficiary of this. Is it the counties, the towns, both, neither? Well, can't be neither, but, you know, who's benefiting the most? And our conclusion was that counties were the main beneficiary of this difference. And the reason is because the townships received a fixed amount of PILT. It was 30 cents an acre, it now is, with inflation, 51 cents per acre. But when the legislature allowed for acquired land to get 0.75% of the value of the property, it didn't adjust the township share of that upward. It simply said that will go up with inflation. So it used to be the case that townships got 10% of the PILT for this type of acquired land. They're now getting about 2.5% on average. Township taxes are about 20% of statewide of the combined county town taxes. So it would appear that on several fronts that the townships are losing as a result, and the counties are getting far more than what they need on this type of land. We did do a subsequent analysis on acquired hunting land, and rather than 64%, I think the estimate is that for newly acquired land, the PILT is about 27% higher than county town taxes. Again, that's a state average. It varies around the state. It's a lot lower than for non-hunting land because when you talk about hunting land, you've got to consider the taxes that were being paid to the school district because the school district receives that type of PILT. We did not make specific recommendations about what should be done in the area of PILT, but I think there are a number of different questions that the legislature could consider. One is, obviously, is PILT for acquired non-hunting lands too high? And secondly, should townships get a greater share of PILT for acquired non-hunting lands? I would just comment that share that townships get is not an issue, I don't think, with hunting lands. Because for hunting lands, the townships, the counties, and the school districts, I believe, all get their PILT in relationship, in proportion to their tax rates and their taxes. So it's done in a way for hunting lands that kind of gets around this issue and probably makes a roughly fair apportionment of the PILT, but not so for the non-hunting acquired lands. We also think there's an issue here that could be looked at as to whether school districts should continue to receive PILT for acquired hunting lands or whether school districts should receive PILT for non-hunting lands. Which way do you want to go? We're going two different ways on two different types of land. Does that make sense? And I'm going to talk just a little bit about the school districts in a minute because it's a fairly complicated situation. And then finally, just kind of an unrelated issue here, cities do not receive PILT, but there are some cities who have state land. In at least one case that I'm aware of, they have some fairly significant costs for providing services to that land, and yet they don't receive PILT. So if state land is in the city, should they receive it instead of just the county? Because the county would get all of it because there is no township involved. School districts, you might ask, how are school districts affected by state land purchases? How does this affect them? And the answer is very complicated because Minnesota has a fairly complicated property tax system and we have a fairly complicated school aid formula system. For the most part, though, I would say that school district revenues, overall revenues, are not affected by the purchase of land. They can affect, however, tax rates for debt service levies. It can affect the impact, that impact on school tax rate, on school property tax rates could affect voters' willingness to pass referendums. But if you look at the last point, it gets very complicated when you're talking about operating referendum levies. Tax rates for operating referendum levies are not affected by purchases of ag non-homestead land, non-commercial seasonal recreational property, and most of the acreage on ag homestead land. Those types of properties are not taxed for operating levy purposes, so if the state purchases its land, that land, it doesn't affect school district taxes. If part of the purchase is ag homestead land, that portion that includes the house, the garage, and 1 acre of land, that would be affected. So there is a route here where there would be an effect, but much of the property that probably is being purchased is not affected. That concludes the presentation, and Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to answer any questions of the council.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Junker and Mr. Noble. It's time for some questions. Start.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, you know, we're hitting one side of the equation that we lose property tax when land becomes owned by the public. And I'm just wondering, is that, have there been any studies or any data that would give us an insight into, okay, the public land is there, it's not producing taxes, but it is drawing people there, it is drawing birders and hunters and so forth. Is there some sort of offset of any value or significance there, or do we just simply not know? Have the studies not been done?
Mr. Younger?
Well, maybe the chairman might know about that. I'm sure there are studies out there that talk about, you know, the tourism values. But, you know, we did not try, you know, this would have been a major, major undertaking for us to try to look at not only that, but also all of the other fiscal impacts that state land purchases have on local governments, both positive and negative. And we felt that that was just really beyond the scope of this study. But, you know, are there studies out there that look at, you know, what some of those tourism impacts are? I'm sure there are. Do they look at how then that trickles down to the finances of the local government? So you've got more activity. What impact does that have on local government revenues? I'm not aware of any.
And, Mr. Chairman, I might add, I mean, because the equation probably goes both ways, with increased traffic, increased tourism, there may be some economic benefit. I think you also have to enter into the equation who benefits from that in terms of the tax impact and the revenue impact. It could be accrued to the state through sales tax, but costs could be incurred by the local unit of government for increased police protection, road maintenance, and other things. So it does get very complicated, but I think it is something people need to think through, but it is very hard to get to a definitive conclusion. Speaking of which, I'd just like to add one comment to Senator Ingebretson's question, because I think it's really a very key point out of all this report, and that is, how do we come to a conclusion about what is adequate? And there is not a fixed answer to that. There's not just one right answer. And I think what we are saying is that we need to really increase the amount of information that is around that question and the discussion. And, you know, to draw a bit of an analogy, I guess, that all of us can probably understand, is that there's not just one right answer to how much money we should put into the maintenance of our home. And as we look around our neighborhood, people have different levels of expectation and maybe tolerance. Some people can kind of let their windows go, or the painting on the side or the yard or whatever. And we just think that there needs to be more information about, first of all, what do the experts and professionals in DNR think they need to adequately maintain a park, a trail, a scientific natural area? I mean, if we were to just have the ideal from a professional scientific point of view, what would that number be? Now, that may not be the number that the Commissioner of Natural Resources is willing to put forth in a budget request. And we understand that, particularly in this environment and particularly what Representative Hansen said, because it could be a big number that the commissioner and the governor simply don't want to put out there and will not support. Even if they were, it may not be a number you can support, given the economic conditions. But again, I think there just needs to be a better discussion, first of all, about what is the condition of the land we've acquired. You can't go, I mean, you folks go out a lot in terms of your legislative travels and to the council, but you can't be everywhere and know the condition of every park, every trail, every wildlife area, scientific area. And so DNR needs to do that for you and provide you with that information. You probably also get some feedback from citizens who visit those areas and see those. So again, there isn't just one answer to that. But we think that clearly there needs to be better information about what are we aiming for when we acquire land. From the ideal, but also what would be the minimum? What would be acceptable short of the ideal? And then maybe we're at a point where we can't even do that. And so if we can't do what is the minimum to advance that program that we wanted to advance on acquiring that land, what's the plan going forward? When are we going to get there? How are we going to get there? Or is that land that we need to put up for exchange or sale? So that's the kind of dialogue we're looking to have, Mr. Chairman, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Jim.
Well, Mr. Nobles, but on that point, you did make the determination that there wasn't enough money put for restoration or maintenance of these properties. So what did you base that on? Well, is there a level right now that the state is using to maintain those properties? Do you know what that is? Do you know what the current level is?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Pat, you'll notice that our finding has a conditional word in it. And, you know, Mr. Yonker can tell you, I don't like that. I like a finding to be absolute and definitive. But we also have to be cautious and careful. We have to be able to back up what we say. And so you'll see in slide 14 that the bullet says DNR appears to lack. So it's a little bit conditional. And it is because it's a more reasonable statement than an absolute definitive statement because of all the reasons that Mr. Yonker went through. In some areas, we don't have enough information to know what we're aiming to achieve. So it really depends on what kind of land. But to really get to your point, I think there are some areas, particularly in parks and trails, because the legislature required DNR to provide better information, we have a better idea. And so in some areas, we know more definitively from objective data, what is the condition of buildings, what is the condition of roads, what is the condition of parks, trails, all those things. And those are firmer numbers about the gap. But if you get into some other areas, scientific natural areas and some others, where we simply haven't done the work to set the mark on what we're trying to achieve and where we are in relationship to that goal. So it varies. And we had to put that conditional statement in there because of that. And I don't know if Mr. Yonker wants to add to that, but just, again, I ask you to keep in mind that we did not make a definitive statement that the state is falling short. But from the data we were able to see and the professionals we talked to, and again, one of the things that is achieved by this kind of evaluation is that we get deep into the organization. We don't just meet with the commissioner and the deputies and assistants. We go deep into the organization and talk to people out in the field. And we look at a lot of data. So we think there is evidence within DNR that suggests that they don't have adequate resources.
Mr. Nobles, on that very point, I mean, one of the things that has frustrated this council greatly is when we ask for the question of the deferred needs for habitat enhancement work, particularly what you call hunting lands, the wildlife management area lands, and the answer was, and as you point out in your report, we don't know. And just building on your last comment that you really dig deep into the organization when you do these types of program evaluations, is there something unique about the wildlife section? Or, I mean, I looked down on slide 15 and you have numbers and some guesstimates for almost every other division in the department, but wildlife. Is it an information management problem? Can you give us a sense of why that occurs so uniquely in wildlife? Because we have all these other divisions that are managing very large asset portfolios, yet you can pin some numbers down for those, but not for wildlife.
Yes, you know? It is an information management issue, and that's how I posed it, is that the department, that particular part of the department, needs an information management system to kind of quantify what those needs are, what the condition of the wildlife management areas are, and what their kind of annual need is to keep those areas in adequate condition. You know, they kind of do their work from the bottom up, and, you know, here's the budget, and here's how much money you've got to do. Well, prioritize what you've got to do, but they don't have a management information system that tells them those kind of key things that they need. And that's why they don't have any kind of an estimate. Even some of the other areas, like scientific and natural areas, have some pretty, you know, decent estimates, even though they don't have a management information system. They've got some pretty good estimates that they've developed or could provide for us. So, yes, it is an information management issue.
Brian? As a former wildlife employee, I'm just going to not comment on that whole part. But one of the recommendations that you mentioned,
So the disposal of surplus land, and I'm trying to get my head around what surplus land actually is. And then you had also mentioned that the DNR actually has some up for sale right now, and it hasn't sold. Could you go into a little detail about what surplus land is,
Mr. Yonker?
Well, you know, it's a little difficult to be specific about, but it's land that DNR has tried to look. They've tried to look at their land and say, you know, is this land serving its purpose? They may have had some hunting land, for example, some wildlife land that now development has encroached around that land, and it can't be used for hunting anymore. And so they would much prefer to acquire other land to replace that land, sell that land. It doesn't have hunting values. It doesn't have significant wildlife management values. So sell that land and purchase other land. They did sell a parcel down in the Rochester area. I think that was more than $1 million, and where that was the case, and they've got some other parcels available in the Hastings area, which would be several million dollars worth. They're very close in to where the city is. It just doesn't make sense to keep that land as hunting land. It'd be better to purchase other land and to sell that land for other purposes. So that's an example of the kinds of things they look at. But they might have odd parcels, things that just don't suit their purpose anymore. And they've had other land where they've got facilities that they no longer use. And so they've identified some land that really doesn't fit their mission anymore.
Follow, Mr. Chairman. I think that illustrates perhaps some important policy, philosophical things that we need to look at long term. You know, we've looked at a lot of urban acquisitions and urban restorations, and when you look at some of these surplus lands, these are former functioning wildlife management areas that are now surrounded by urban development. Long term, we should be cognizant of the fact that sometimes when we make investments in that near urban ring, we're creating a future problem because we know there's going to be development around it. So those are some philosophical issues as a council, as a state, as a wildlife agency, DNR, I think should really be looking at. And that adds complexity to this whole metro urban discussion. The sale of surplus land, I often hear some of my good friends, rural legislators, talking about how the state needs to sell off land in their area, and these are functioning wildlife management areas, oftentimes not managed to the level that they should be. We all know that the state of wildlife management areas in a lot of places isn't to the level that it needs to be. We need to do a better job. I mean, I think that's why the voters, in large part, voted for the amendment, knowing that there's a lot of work to be done. The bigger philosophical debate is whether we should keep buying land while we know that we've got these deferred maintenance issues. As a council, maybe we should be talking about that over the next year or so as we look at what projects we're funding. I don't necessarily agree that we need to stop purchasing land and focus exclusively on restoration projects, but this report brings up some interesting points. I don't agree necessarily with all of them, but I think those are some philosophical discussions we should have as a council. Big policy things.
Rick, you got a question? On the issue of the surplus land sales, there was actually a provision passed in the Game and Fish Bill to allow low-cost sales because they're not in the current economic environment. The DNR is not able to move some surplus land, so they're actually putting it up for sale at less than the current value. So it's not moving.
Bill.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Yonkers, I'm fascinated with this report, especially to the extent that you were able to look at how the agency puts together its plans for working on wildlife management areas and natural lands. D- did you have much of an opportunity to get into the way the agency develops its budgets or spending plans in this information void that they have?
Mr. Yonker?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Becker, no, we did not. I appreciate the comments you made earlier about how comprehensive the report is, but the fact of the matter is we had to look at some very selected issues in order to get the work done. And so there are a number of areas where we didn't look at certain issues.
To the council, to the extent that what comes before us in terms of requests is a manifestation of some system that the department uses to gather its needs and present them to us, it might be interesting to have the department come in and explain how they do that, just so we understand better what we're looking for.
Very good.
Mr. Chairman, I would just add to that, and I'm probably not adding anything that any of you don't already know, but just to amplify it, and certainly Mr. Becker, having worked there on the inside, probably knows, and others here know more than the rest of us, but having observed DNR over the years, you know, I think we all recognize, and it was an element in this report, and so it's not irrelevant. DNR is a very, very complicated place, in part because it's trying to serve a lot of competing and sometimes even conflicting interests, and I think that definitely comes into play as they develop their budget and bring it forward. So, although, as Mr. Yonker said, we didn't look explicitly at it, but I think just being there, talking to people about their programs, about their needs, about their resources, you do come to an understanding generally that it is an extremely complex environment and that the commissioner has to take all of those conflicting, competing interests and interest groups that are out there that are constantly putting pressure on the department. And he has to try to come to some resolution of that. He has to deal with the governor's office and those priorities and those interests. And then he has to come over here and deal with you and deal with the legislature. And, you know, I think as you read the commissioner's response to our report, I think that some of the pressure and even frustration that he feels comes through. And if you've attended any of the hearings where he's been present and responded to our report, you've heard him amplify on that. I often tell the commissioner, I understand, I think, the very difficult and complicated world that you work in. I know that every day I don't feel it like you do. And he definitely agrees that no one can quite feel it unless you're in that chair.
Thank you.
Darby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to just very briefly go back to school trust fund lands, and I realize that we're really running low on time, so I'll try to make it quick. But I'm aware that there are some, well, we have not put much money from the school trust fund lands into schools' hands and over the decades. And I know that a number of folks in the House, Representative Dietrich in particular, is very concerned that we really need to sort of keep the faith of the Constitution and move some of that money into the schools. And I'm wondering, and I don't know, maybe Rick or Greg are better suited to answer the question, but if we were to make some moves in that direction, right now it's basically we got de facto conservation going on in a lot of places. The land is just sitting there. And I'm wondering if there is a move, if Representative Dietrich and others are successful, what is the impact? Can we anticipate an impact on the conservation purposes that would be lost or whatever? Do you understand what I'm asking?
Mr. Nobles or Mr. Yonker?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Nelson, I think all of us here, especially you all at that table, understand that what was just raised is one of the perennial points of conflict and controversy within the department. And when the commissioner and others come over here, they have to deal with that issue because, as we all know, it's supposed to generate revenue. And yet, you saw from the pie chart, that's a big piece of the land that the department manages for many other purposes and interests that aren't necessarily producing revenue. And so as the legislature pulls in the direction of wanting revenue off of that land for the educational system, you've got all these other folks and interests the concern that you just expressed about what happens to the conservation interest. And those conservation interests in and of themselves, that word can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. I mean, is it hunting? Is it conservation for hunting? For other kinds of recreational activities? And I don't think anybody here can tell you what is ultimately going to happen to that. I just think it's going to be a constant pressure. So I'll throw that one over to Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair Darby, I think what has happened this last session is we did pass a resolution trying to take this issue in pieces because it is a source of strong conflict. And so the school trust lands in the BWCA, we did pass a resolution to Congress trying to deal with that. If you could deal with just that particular piece of it, you know, maybe there's some progress on the overall issue because that's a more definable set area. When we get to the larger issue that school trust lands in is the goal to obtain the best revenue. And if, you know, that could be a different goal. You can mine it, or you can log it, or you can sell it for development and put big cabins on it and get the revenue for the schools. But then what is the management, or what is the state that it should be in? And that's where you have this constant conflict that comes as the demand on the schools reaches, we have the constitutional thing saying we should provide revenue. So what Representative Dietrich did is, I think there was even a subcommittee in the House where Utah has a similar program, but Utah has oil and gas, you know, on there. So it's we don't have oil and gas. We have other resources. So there's been a lot of testimony on this issue. It continues to be an issue of conflict. There's going to be more pressure. But I think what the major kind of trying to deal with it beyond that resolution just ran into a buzzsaw. Because you have different visions of what that means. And you have this spectrum of education or obtaining as much money as possible. Well, you could probably obtain as much money as possible, but what's left with that land having been done? So that's where the conflict comes in. I think the BWCA thing may be more manageable and more definable, and hopefully maybe can open this up a little bit where there's actual resolution on some pieces.
I know we're running late, so we need to wrap up. I do have one final question, though, for Mr. Junker. You mentioned that you did some subsequent analysis on the WMA, the Wildlife Management Area Land Acquisition, and on average, the revenue that local units of government, counties, school districts, and townships received is on average 20% higher than the property tax that would have been generated from those properties had they been held in private ownership. Are there any particular areas of the state where you found that that was not the case, where the PILT was insufficient? Are there any characteristics of the land? Because as you are well aware, and as was indicated earlier, there is pushback about the notion of acquiring and protecting land for conservation purposes. The state already has a large enough portfolio. We don't need any more. And in particular, it costs us as local units of government. Adversity. So are there particular areas, particular characteristics of the land, of the units of government that suggest where WMAs are acquired, the PILT is not adequate?
Mr. Chairman, the number was 27%. I do not recall, and I mean, obviously we did this for each county and then averaged it across the state. Certainly there would be some counties that be above that 27%, some that would be below, some that are undoubtedly have a negative number, which would indicate that it's not sufficient to match the property taxes lost. But I do not recall offhand what particular areas those would be. It certainly would depend on the relative tax rates, among other things. And so jurisdictions with higher tax rates would tend to be those where the PILT is not adequate or is not as high as in other areas relative to the taxes lost.
Mr. Chairman, I know we have to end, but I think this is just a point where we think... And we've had some conversations with both in the legislature, but it could occur at other places where somebody needs to take some of the analysis that we've done and carry it forward. I think one of the problems with TILT is that it's talked about in general terms. TILT is either good, bad, high, low. And what we know from the presentation that you had today and your question, it gets much more specific than that. And so although we presented some general numbers, we also had some more detailed specific analysis. But I think over the long run, sort of like with school aids in the legislature, there's been some very good establishment of databases, some modeling of the impacts that can do some scenario analysis. We aren't in a position as an office to carry that forward, but I hope somebody will, because frankly, even though it has a big impact in natural resource land, DNR really does not do much analysis at all, and no disrespect intended, but doesn't have a great deal of expertise in this area of TILT. Even though it gives rise to a lot of issues, it isn't something anywhere in state government, frankly, where you find the level and sophistication of analysis that I think we need on an ongoing basis to answer some of the questions like you just asked.
Mr. Nobles, if you're not the right person to ask for that kind of more detailed analysis, who is?
Mr. Nobles?
Who has the data, first of all?
Well, for this little slice, I mean, we can certainly provide you with some additional data for what we have done. But as you know, I'm sure, the nature of the Office of the Legislative Auditor is that we do this kind of report, and then we move on to other assignments. As Mr. Yunker well knows, for the last several months, he has been dealing with a totally different topic than natural resource land management, and he will for the end of the year. That's the nature of who we are and what we do. We have 12, 13 evaluators. They did 6 evaluations last year. They're doing totally unrelated evaluations this year. So we have no continuing ongoing resource to put into this. We would be happy to transfer that to this council, to House Research, Senate Council, Department of Revenue, DNR. So we have a base of knowledge here that somebody could pick up on. But exactly who we transfer that to and who you ask those questions of, I don't have an answer for you.
Thank you.
Mr. Nobles, Mr. Young, thank you so much for the presentation. And
thank you.
We'll look forward to that follow-up information, particularly as it relates to the wildlife management.
Thank you.
We are running a bit behind, but we indicated at our meeting last month that as a standing agenda item through the end of the year, we would get an update on the 25-year framework process meeting grouping. Management analysis is here, and Judy, just recognizing that we are running a bit late, I know we allocated 15 minutes, but if we can do that in half the time or even less,
I'll shoot for 5.
That would be wonderful.
I was just wondering, though, if the council members needed a 5-minute break or anything.
No, we'll keep going. Well, individual members can exercise that break.
We folks are in chairs for an hour and a half, I always say. I'm Judy Grew for Management Analysis and Development, or MAD for short. We've been working with you for the last few months developing your 25-year framework of funding. We spoke with you in Fergus Falls at your last meeting and talked about the 25-year framework, what it might look like, some of the suggestions the Council Chairman Kilgore had made, how we had developed those suggestions with an advisory group, and how we're moving on now to kind of do the heavy lifting with a working group. That funding framework is really organized around 3 concepts. One is a baseline scenario where we're going to kind of describe what is, as we're calling it in our team meetings, the conservation estate in Minnesota. What is it that we're building upon? The second piece of that is a 2-year funding trajectory based on the first 2 years of funding that you've developed at the council. If we stretch some of those investments out for the next 23 years, spatially, what does that look like? What does that look like in terms of investments? And just sort of describe what can be accomplished in 23 years. The third piece is a maximized opportunity scenario, where from that two-year trajectory of funding, if we were to do essentially a sensitivity analysis on that trajectory and sort of move those investments in different directions, what are some different funding scenarios and what might they look like? You approved the framework plan and concept at your last meeting and authorized the funding. The details of that were also provided in the administrative budget that you approved earlier in this meeting. Our working group met on June 3rd, and this was really the first meeting where the working group could really roll up their sleeves and develop a work plan to develop this framework for you. Our first meeting was really mostly concerned with getting them contexted on what some of the council's needs are and what some of the advice that had been offered from the advisory group. The group spent about the first hour of the meeting. Chairman Kilgore was generous enough to give us about an hour of his time. Of the work group members, just asking Chairman Kilgore directly, what are some of your needs and concerns, any analytical questions that they had about how to get the project done. And now that Chairman Kilgore is back in the room, just wanted to thank him for his time.
What did I do now?
We're just thanking you for your time and meeting with the working group and talking to them about the framework at their last meeting. Then they spent the rest of the time just working on the baseline scenario and how will we get that accomplished. It's a description of the conservation estate in Minnesota, and a lot of that information is just available from existing data sets and existing reports. It's a summary of research that's existing, but there is some original data collection that we think that we'll need to do for that baseline piece, and we just spent the rest of our meeting talking about what questions do we want to ask of the different conservation partners about their investments in Minnesota. In particular, we want to work with them and ask them about some of the constraints that they believe that they'll be facing in the next 5 to 23 years, and that's not information that's available in a lot of existing reports. We made assignments to the various team members. We've got two folks, Andy Holdsworth and Leslie McKinley, who is actually here today. They're putting together a data call, the questions that we want to ask of various conservation partners for the baseline data collection. Tabor Holka Bowser is trying to put together a list of the top 20 that we're calling it. We know that we're going to have a limited amount of time this summer. We're trying to develop a list of the top 20 conservation partners in the state from whom we want to collect the information for the baseline data collection. Heather Koop and Rudy Butler, Peter Butler, are working on that two-year funding trajectory piece. They're just getting started with loading in the first 2 years of your funding, looking at that funding scenario and how might we want to project that out for the next 23 years. I'm playing Judy, the cruise director, doing a lot of meeting planning, trying to get our schedule set for the summer, getting our milestones set, and that sort of thing. That's what we're up to. I do that in about 3 minutes. Talk a little fast. Any questions about the 25-year funding framework, what we're up to?
Questions for Judy? Rick?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Grew, just thought of it, I wasn't at the last meeting, but is there any thought of having maybe some neutral group like the League of Women Voters or some kind of outside that's not a conservation professional who would be ex officio or advisory to the process? And my reason for asking that is conservation professionals belong to organizations or agencies that will be seeking funds over the 25 years. And I think it would be good to have somebody at the table or in the room who's from maybe an outside or good government type of review who doesn't have an interest in receiving funds that the plan could perhaps provide.
Representative Hansen, that's a really interesting idea. One of the contributions that we make as a division, management analysis, is similar to the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We go in, we study different topics, we work on projects. We don't have a stake in the outcome, and we move on to our next gate, just like the Legislative Auditor. I see it as my job and Peter Butler's job as well for management analysis is to be that check on the objectivity of the group, to be looking for any evidence of bias of anyone attempting to influence the analysis with the direction of supporting a particular outcome. That's just something we're trained to do. But there might be some additional people who can be that sort of external check, somebody who isn't necessarily a conservation professional but can keep a watch on the process.
Just let me add to that, Judy. I mean, what you said is precisely the reason why this council contracted with management analysis is for that, to manage the process from an independent third-party perspective and a party that has the experience in managing processes.
And I haven't really stressed it with our working group because I felt it hasn't been necessary, but we've really stressed here that our job here is an analytical task. It's describing for you your funding framework, your 23-year scenarios, and looking at your vision, your mission, your vision, and your goals for the various sections, and just trying to help you see what that might look like. We're not trying to substitute or usurp the role in any way of establishing that vision for the various sections of the state and what it is that we're trying to accomplish. And we've just tried to make it clear that's the council's role, and it's not a role that that our working group needs to take on or feel that we need to run a process to contribute to. That's essentially what this council is for.
Sure.
I was just going to say basically what Judy just said. Rick wasn't at our last meeting, but, I mean, this is not going to be a roadmap as to how the funds are going to be spent. This is, as Mike has described, it's just going to be a straight line. How far could we go if we did a one way, two ways, or three ways? So there's not going to be any direction of these funds through this plan, so I think it's a moot point.
Judy, I'll ask you, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being I'm extremely comfortable, 1 being I'm really nervous, where we are in the process and what we have to do to meet the legislative deadline, where are we? What's your number you're going to throw back at the council?
10 is very nervous.
No, 10 is I am so comfortable.
Sorry.
I can't believe it.
Oh, goodness. Maybe about a 5 or a 6. What we're really trying to do is wrestle with the different trajectories and funding scenarios, looking at the data that we have, and then just trying to sketch out a working plan for what can we get accomplished in the next few months. And that's just a, you know, roll up your sleeves, get the group together, and just try to figure out what we can get done over the summer. So,
any other questions? If not, Judy will be, again, this is a standing agenda item through the rest of this calendar year. Until the framework is developed, we'll have time on the agenda for Judy to update us where we are, issues, strategies. Thank you.
The next item on our agenda is the presentation by the Forest Resources Council and the Forest Resource Partnership, Al Sullivan and Robert Sounder. The gentleman could step up. Pleasure to have you, Council. We appreciate your coming today. I might add that in your packet is a letter from the Forest Resources Council, as well as a document that is a 25-year vision provided by the council. Gentlemen.
Sunberg and Dr. Sullivan, good morning and thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Good morning, Chair Kilgore, members of the Sauk Sound Outdoor Heritage Council. We're delighted to be here with you this morning to formally transmit to you the work we've been engaged in upon invitation of your chair to present something I think will be a supplement to the good work you're doing about a vision to help select investments that protect, restore, or enhance our forest and fish game and wildlife habitat. My name is Al Sullivan, and I am chair of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. Of course, this is Bob Sonnenberg with me, who's the immediate past chair of the Minnesota Forest Resources Partnership. Because of the time constraints, Bob's asked me to do the presentation, but we'll both be here to stand for any questions if you have in the room. Both of our organizations grew out of the 1995 Sustainable Forest Resources Act. The Forest Resources Council is charged in statute to advise the governor and federal, state, county, and local governments on sustainable forest resources policies and practices. We have 15 members and a chair that are appointed by the governor, and one additional member that's appointed by the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. Representatives on the council who come from a diverse set of backgrounds, from forest industry to the labor unions that work in the mills, to conservation organizations, environmental organizations, tourism representative, and wild game species management organizations. Minnesota Forest Resources Partnership is a voluntary, self-funded partnership of forest landowners and managers. Their mission is to implement and coordinate scientifically based, technically and economically feasible forest management practices to provide sustainable forest resources and promote economic viability. As I indicated in my very first remarks, back in the summer of last year, your chair came to both organizations independently and invited us to submit ideas because of our background and our work and our missions that might be helpful to this council in carrying out your unique and very important vital mission. As we began to think about that, both organizations had started down a path to discussing how to do this work, and I think from the planning you're doing and developing of your vision statements, I think you know what a daunting task can be. Bob and I met and had a very great and cordial meeting and concluded that there's very little point in each of us independently tackling this and that we might as well work together. And so that's what we have done over the past almost year now, with a joint vision committee from both the council and the partnership on this. The work has been facilitated by our council staff and very importantly by our regional landscape committees. These are scattered throughout the state. They're volunteer citizen-based organizations with diverse interests that cooperatively promote forest sustainability, and I would say that easily over 100 very committed citizens have participated in the work presented here today by the council and the partnership to bring this work together. Our joint report, which I think was distributed in advance, you have in your packets, and there's a lot of detail in it today, and I am not prepared, nor do I think you want me to go through it in detail about it, but the thing we're formally conveying you to today is really a supplement to your own excellent vision that we think might offer additional detail for your consideration as you go forward. In some sense, we consider our own work a draft, and I'm sure that over 25 years, or what's left of the 25 years, you'll probably tweak a thing or two yourselves as you go forward. We tried to develop something that would be as succinct as possible, but as complete as possible. I guess the jury will be out on how successful we were with that. I think it's also very important to say that, not trying to be overly presumptuous, but we tried to view this issue through your lens and what you're trying to accomplish in your own unique mission. So the proposed vision that we put forward here is not, for example, that of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, which we have our own, which goes a little bit beyond us, and it's on our website, and the partnership has theirs as well. So we've tried to, as much as we could, put ourselves in your place and look at the issue of enhancing forest, fish, game, and wildlife habitat. We also present our views in terms of your five regions, which differ slightly, not materially, but they're not exactly the same as the regions that our council has been using for many years. So we shifted from our boundaries to yours, thinking that would be a little bit more helpful to you, so that you didn't have to do the translation. We've done that for you. So say you have the document, and I don't want to go through it line by line or anything even approaching that, but just to highlight it, it starts with a statewide vision that we tried to get on two pages, but as it prints out, we missed out a little bit. It's two pages and one bullet.
but it talks about the goals to accomplish, you know, it presents a vision, a statewide forest vision, and the goals to accomplish the vision, highlighting those. Minnesota's forests are restored and enhanced. Minnesota's forest land base is enlarged and protected. Forest-based recreational and economic opportunities are numerous. And finally, forests are managed to ensure healthy fish and wildlife populations, lethal for economic and social sustainability. And then we have some statewide funding priorities that are, you know, from the 50,000-foot level, and the funding priorities in the northern forest and the other sections. That statewide vision is followed then by visions for each of your five sections, of course, realizing they're focusing on the forestry issues because that's what our business is. Each of those then is presented on two pages. So just to take, for example, to look at the one that immediately follows the state line, it's the northern forest section. Starts off, I'll just show you the pattern. It starts off with a little boilerplate paragraph up at the top, and then there's a section description that sort of highlights for our people you know, key things about the size of it, percent in private ownership, what pre-settlement forests cover, and what today's situation is. So, for example, over 88% of this section is covered in forest in pre-settlement time, and 69% of that. Highlights the significant forest wildlife species, that's under heading, and then forest and forest habitat conservation opportunities. This is where we're going down a little bit from the 30,000, from the 50,000 to maybe the 25,000 foot level. And then on the facing page over there, we have a map that we have put together. And again, you know, this is based on the council work, the partnership work that relied very heavily on this regional landscape committee of dedicated professionals and landowners up in that region who volunteer their time to, and have been doing it for years to be really engaged with what should happen in that landscape. I think one thing I really want to point out, there's sort of a note there by that map that's very important. And it says identification of priority areas on this map is not intended to be all-inclusive. Projects outside identified areas should also be considered based upon statewide recommendations and sectional or regional goals. In other words, there's no possible way we can get down to a particular track, nor do we want to get into the process of trying to, you know, recommend projects. That's not our job. You know, that's for you folks to sort out. But we're trying to provide helpful information based on you know, our mandates and our missions that would be helpful to you. So that's sort of what it looks like. The other four would go in that same way. And in conclusion, I'd just like to say that we really do appreciate the invitation to provide something like this. It gave us the incentive to tackle something very difficult. And beyond whatever use that you're able to make of it, it'll be very helpful to us and our own organizations as we go forward with our work. I, speaking personally, really appreciate the opportunity to work with a partnership and to get to know Bob Sonnenberg, you know, just a great gentleman. I appreciate deeply, and all of us on the Forest Resources Council do, that our staff is now actively involved with you and your staff as you go forward. We think that's a lot of synergy. And of course, as I say, there's a lot of detail in relatively few pages here, and there's backup behind it. And as you go forward with your work, you're engaged with our staff. I'm sure they're going to be happy to help you in any way, as would our organization. So, thank you very much. It's been a very enlightening task for us, and we consider it a draft at this point ourselves.
Al, thank you. Are there questions for Dr. Sullivan or Mr. Sonnenberg now?
Brian. Spectacular document. One of the forest types that you didn't cover in this was oak savanna, and you specifically excluded that because on page, I don't know what it is, there's a footnote that says that because it's comprised mostly of prairie species. Is there no significant forestry management economic derivatives from oak savanna? Is there no, what's the value in oaks? In the oak savanna mix from a forest management standpoint, the forest products industry?
Chair Kilgore, Ms. Bronson. No, I would not say that at all. It's just in terms of what we were trying to accomplish here with the thing, we didn't, you know, there were limits to our resources, and that was an area with relatively little forest in it. But clearly, there would be some economic value to that.
Okay. Other questions? I guess I would echo Ryan's comment. I really like the format, and this will be extremely useful as we move forward with the framework. Obviously, you mentioned your staff are heavily involved working with Judy and others on developing that 25-year framework for us, and so this will be excellent information that we can incorporate as the vision and the context for describing those different scenarios. Any last an opportunity for questions, comments? If not, Sonnenberg, Dr. Sullivan, thank you so much, and again, please express our appreciation to your organization for this work.
Thank you.
Well, very well done.
Enjoy your field trip.
Thank you.
Bill. Next on the agenda is the decision item, which is accomplishment plan approval. You have, I hope, your three-ring binder with the accomplishment plan. In addition, in your packet is a list that's titled Top Consent List Accomplishment Plans for Approval, and then down below, about two-thirds of the way down, hearing list. I'm going to turn this over to Ms. Cooper in a moment to explain, but essentially what we have here is the staff recommendation that needs to be adjusted, if necessary, by members as to what we thought the consensus to be on the projects that need not have a hearing for the accomplishment plan and could be approved with a motion, and then the hearing list. As for the hearing list, we're going to proceed down it in order. We do have to wrap up here at about a quarter till 12, so that means that we may have to lay some of these over until the August 16th meeting. So with that, Heather, could you let the council know what we've got before them?
Sure. You have a list in front of you, I believe. As Bill indicated, this is a list that we developed after staff review and looking at the accomplishment plans and seeing if they had the necessary information for approval. Very quickly, they're divided in between the four subdivisions of prairies, forests, wetlands, and habitat. As you can see, it is fairly it entails most of the accomplishment plans, and I would stand for any questions at this time regarding these plans listed on this list.
So members, we have, as proposed by staff, a consent list, which would mean that we would take up all of the accomplishment plans that are included on the consent list at once with a motion and an adoption of those accomplishment plans, which would then trigger the ability for them to move forward and to start using the outdoor heritage funds to pursue the protection, enhancement, and restoration activities that are specified. This is a consent agenda, so we would need unanimous consent from the council members that this list is complete. So now is the time to speak as members looking at the list, and there are six of them, as you can see, actually seven, below the line that are not on the consent list that we would then take up individually, as Bill said, in order as listed. But now's the time, if you feel that there's one that's on the list that you would like to have some conversation about, let's hear that now. We can remove that from the consent list. I guess conversely, if you see that there's one below that should be put on the consent list and we have no opposition from the council members, we can do that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Scott.
Is Sandy going to be emailing me that list? I do not have that.
It's on the web, but I think, Scott, for your benefits, you're not trying to look on the web and listen. Heather, could you just go down the consent list? Scott, if you look at the front of your booklet, you've got a summary of the appropriations by...
Yep.
Okay. So say,
yep.
Heather, can you go through that?
Starting with prairies, subdivision 2. 2A, accelerated prairie grassland restoration and enhancement program and DNR lands. 2C, prairie heritage fund acquisition and restoration. 2D, Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge Protection, 2E, Rum River Cedar Creek Initiative. Subdivision 3, Forests. 3C, Little Mississippi River Wildlife Management Area. 3E, Northeastern Minnesota Sharp-tailed Grouse Habitat. Subdivision 4, Wetlands. 4A, Accelerated Shallow Lake and Wetland Enhancement and Restoration Program. 4B, Accelerated Waterfowl Production Area Program in Minnesota. 4C, Reinvest in Minnesota Wetlands Reserve Program Acquisition and Restoration. Subdivision 5, Habitat. 5A, Metro Big Rivers Habitat Program. 5B, Accelerated Aquatic Management Area Acquisition. 5C, Coldwater River and Stream Restoration Protection and Enhancements. 5E, Valley Creek Protection Partnership. 5F, Anoka Sand Plain Restoration and Enhancement. 5G, Lower Mississippi River Habitat Restoration Acceleration. 5H, Washington County St. Croix River Land Protection. And 5I, Outdoor Heritage Conservation Partners Grant Program.
Thank you, Heather. Scott, did you get all those?
I got them. Thank you.
Great. Members, in your packet, there is a motion that staff has drafted for this consent list. I would look for someone to move that motion. Rick?
I move to approve the accomplishment plans on the consent list contingent upon program managers filing the following items with the Outdoor Heritage Council. And those items are listed there.
Okay. So we have a motion on the floor to approve the accomplishment plan for those on the consent list with those four enumerated items that are listed on the motion. Everyone has the motion in their packet. Further discussion on that motion to approve the consent list with those four requirements as specified in the motion. Hearing none. All those in favor of adopting the motion as proposed, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. So those items that Heather read off are now, those accomplishment plans have been approved. I would ask, though, that as we go through the remaining accomplishment plans, program managers who are in the audience, we may come back and just ask questions either as context or point of comparison or whatever. So if you could stick around, even those on the consent list, that would be greatly appreciated because we may need some additional clarification as we move through these other accomplishment plans. So with that, Bill, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Let's call forward Cynthia Osmussen.
Okay, this would be accomplishment plan for Appropriation 3D, the Accelerated Forest Wildlife Habitat Program. So members, if you could turn to that in your packet.
And the staff evaluation of this raised an issue about costs associated with enhancement work, specifically hydroaxing and burn cost per acre. So if you would please, in your presentation to us, address those issues as best you can. We would appreciate it.
Good morning. Welcome.
Morning. Thank you. Mr. Chairman. Yes, I understand you had questions about some of the cost per acre of the hydroaxing and the prescribed burning. I think I'm going to start by asking Peggy Booth, who's in charge of the SMA program for DNR, to join me. Let me start first with some of the prescribed burning costs. I wanted to point out, and I had a few emails about this back and forth. I've been in Bemidji this week, so just kind of catching up. But all of our prescribed burning included in this project are forest burns. And I know some of those costs may look higher per acre than what you see when you look at prescribed burning costs in grasslands. And indeed, we do feel the costs are higher in forests. There's just more complex systems. There's more safety concerns. You just need to have more people and more equipment on hand. And so the costs are higher, just in general, in the woodlands. And you asked specifically, Bill, about one project, and I do need to follow up on that. There was one on a WMA in our northwest region that I'll get back to on some of those costs. Peggy, do you want to go ahead here for me?
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Peggy Booth, the SNA program supervisor.
And the reason that I am here is in the process of trying to come up with some common terminology between forestry and wildlife and SNA, some words were used and applied in ways that probably in retrospect were not appropriate. So there were a series of SNAs that listed hydroaxing as the activity to be done, when in fact, for the most part, those sites cannot have hydroaxing. They're very steep slopes. They have very sensitive resources, and so all that work would be done by hand. So it would be more appropriate to say that it's native plant community enhancement rather than hydroaxing as the primary activity. So I think that if you compare the costs of some of the sites on the list that you received that were SNAs that said hydroaxing, that was an inappropriate activity to be listed. The net result is very similar. What we're trying to do is to remove woody invasive species. Certainly, we do hydroaxing on some SNAs where we don't have as sensitive an understory or where the slopes are not as steep.
So, Peggy, I'm looking at the last page of your accomplishment plan, which lists the projects, and at the top of the last page, it's not numbered, the third and the fourth rows over have listed as hydroaxing, which you say are hand release activities on the Pine Bend Bluffs SNA and the Cherry Grove Blind Valley SNA.
As well as the Cannon River Turtle Preserve.
Okay. So I look at the cost per acre, whether it be hand release work or hydroaxing, and you know, one of them is $900 an acre, one is $750 an acre. I didn't calculate the third one, but it's in that ballpark, $800 an acre. How do you arrive at those? Those costs seem incredibly high to me for the type of work you're doing. Can you tell me how you arrived at those?
Commission, when we put together this budget, we were making our best estimate on the amount of equipment and staff and contractor work that would be needed. If what we have done in the past with the LCCMR is any indication, we will actually accomplish more acres than we listed here. This was just a conservative estimate based on what it takes in terms of travel time and time in order to do those projects. I guarantee you we will only charge the commission for what it costs. So if it costs less than that, we will come back and say we would like to do additional projects, or we will be doing more acres on those same sites.
So I'm looking down towards the bottom of that page, and if you look at the Power Forestry area in Lake County, you have hand release. And I don't know exactly what you plan to do there, but I have a general idea. And I suspect it's similar in terms of the type. It's manual labor. And the cost there, and then below that, a couple more, they're running in the neighborhood of $175 an acre. So I'm, you know, we're talking about a 5-6-fold difference for essentially the same type of, you're putting people on the ground to do some sort of vegetative management by hand. I'm just really puzzled about the disparity in the per acre cost between the projects when it's actually the same thing.
Yeah, Mr. Kilgore, I would argue that they are not the same thing. The projects, the Cannon River Turtle, the Pine Bend Project, and Cherry Grove Project, are all in the southeastern part of the state where we have extreme problems with woody invasive species and other invasive species which we would be treating here. You just do not find that degree of work, that intensity of work required in the northern forests.
So, like on Pine Bend Bluff, are you on the slope?
Yes.
Part of it, so you've got to have additional people there for safety reasons in addition to the work, or?
Well, Representative Hansen, this involves hand cutting and stump treating of the invasives. It includes hauling them out by hand to an appropriate place where they can be burned or otherwise processed. And so it just takes longer to do it, and there is more of that woody material on the slopes and at the top of the bluffs.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does the forest burning season compare to the traditional grassland burning season? Do they overlap, or they?
They do overlap. We do, you know, we can do forest burns. We'll do some winter burns even in some cases, but during the early spring, which is mainly when the prairie burns are done, that's when most of the forest burns are done as well.
Just like the point out, Mr. Chairman, a number of these projects that we've approved are all hiring their own burn crews, and that was one of the things that I'd hoped that potentially that would be something cooperatively folks would be able to work together on. That, I mean, burn crews are important, and if that's how many folks we need out there running fire lines, but in every individual project seems to have their own burn crew.
So that raises an important question, because a requirement in law, help me out, Greg and Janelle, is that each recipient of the Outdoor Heritage Fund, if they're doing restoration or enhancement work, needs to contact the MCC for assistance in these activities. Isn't that correct? Did you contact the MCC for assistance?
Peggy is telling me she'd like to answer that, and then I'll want to get back to what Mr. Branson said.
It has been our experience that, particularly with prescribed burn, you have such a narrow window of opportunity that we need both MCC and hired crews. And particularly this, if we run into another season like we did in 2010, where all kinds of people, including MCC, were being hauled up north because of the extreme fire conditions, we would not have been able to do any burns. And I'm just speaking in the case of SNA, but we would not have been able to do any burns if we had not had emergency hires on as a burn crew. But we certainly contract with MCC as to the extent that they are available. There's just too much demand in a short time.
So I'm not sure I understood the answer. You've already contacted MCC about doing the work on these projects?
No, I was just responding in general to the use of MCC for burns. We have MCC lined up for projects. Because this work program had not been approved, we have not yet lined them up, but that would be our intention to do that.
Great.
Mr. Chairman, why don't I just read what it says in the law that passed last year with regard to this money. It says a recipient of money from an appropriation in the section must give consideration to and make timely written contact with the Minnesota Conservation Corps or its successor for consideration of possible use of their services to contract for restoration enhancement services. A copy of the written contact must be filed with the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council within 15 days of execution. So basically, they are required to make written contact with the MCC for all restoration enhancement services. And this applies to all projects, not just this one.
And, excuse me, they'll file it with our
office. File it,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I have to admit, I was not aware of that until I spoke with Heather last week or so. So we're catching up on that, and I will certainly do it, and we're happy to work with MCC. I did want to just stay on the burn crews a little bit, and you're seeing some of the complexity that the auditor talked about within the DNR and the different divisions and programs that we have. The burning in the work plan, other than the SNAs, the costs that you're seeing there in terms of personnel are only for overtime to pay Division of Forestry staff for when they're called to assist with prescribed burns. So it's not a separate burn crew. And that just, there are union issues and all where we need to pay that overtime. And these are the kind of skilled, very experienced forest burning people that we need on those burns. So it's not really a roving crew or additional staff for the work that's going on off the SNAs. We did look at joint crews and maybe jointly sponsoring an NCC crew between the forest burning work and the grassland, and then just when our projects got kind of scaled down and all, we tabled that for this fiscal year 11 work. But
could you help me understand how? So you were trying to describe how you arrived at these per acre or these costs. Could you restate that? So I think I understand, but I'm not sure. These costs are based on paying overtime to the DNR crews. Is that what you?
For one factor in the cost figures for the prescribed burning that's going on, not on SNA. So this would be WMAs and state forest land. The personnel costs for that are overtime when DNR forestry staff, who are primarily on staff for wildfire control, are pulled in to do a prescribed burn with us. And you just can't guarantee that the burn is going to end after 8 hours, and then union issues kick in and we're required to pay those people overtime. I do understand it's a bit confusing, but
we're thinking, Mr. Chair, maybe kind of a follow-up on the contact. So let's say you have capacity issues. You don't have staff, or you don't get authorization for overtime. So you've got restoration projects in a limited window. You make the contact MCC, but MCC has limited capacity. So they say, we can do one, but we can't do the rest. So you're done. You've done the contact. You don't have your own staff. So then you can look elsewhere because your staff can't be in multiple places at one time. So then what do you do? Do you go to Great River Greening, or do you go to Friends of Mississippi River, or do you go to other folks to do that? I mean, what's your cascading chain of action when you don't have the capacity to meet the restoration?
Are you referring to only prescribed burning, or not necessarily?
No,
more of a general.
You can talk for control or release or whatever.
We would go, and Peggy might have a different answer, but we would go to one of the many private contractors that we work with and have lined up, and we would set up a contract for doing the mechanical work or hand release or whatever it is.
Rick, Paul? Mr. Chair, so then there is no, just having the contact MCC doesn't limit the capacity question for private. There's enough private contractors out there. There's enough work for everybody out there right now, particularly when you have a tight demand. Then if there's tight demand and there's limited private contractors for the volume, then your contracts go higher for those that may not have the value.
I'm following your logic on that.
Further questions or additional questions? Someone's got a cell phone. Working, so if you've got a cell phone that's active, please turn it on. So we need to get additional information on the activities for these, because some of our are incorrect right now. Bill, do you have a suggestion on how we might proceed?
Well, if council wants to move this onward, I would suggest that we take as the basis the motion to approve the consent list and adapted as follows. On the first line, after the word approve, insert 3D, Accelerated Forest Wildlife Habitat Program. At the end of the consent list motion, add and provision of a list of detailed parcel activity descriptions as part of the accomplishment plan for staff approval. I think that what we've discovered here is that these parcel descriptions are not quite accurate. I think there's a concern that this accomplishment plan is the basis for any future audits, and they'll look to that list to see what you were authorized to pay for and no other description ought to be complete. So that would be the motion, Mr. Chair, that I would suggest.
I would make that motion. Okay, so we have a motion on the floor. Phil, could I follow up one more question? Absolutely. So the motion is on the floor to amend the consent or approve the consent. Restate it, Phil.
The motion's on the floor to approve Project 3D Accelerated Forest Wildlife Habitat Program.
Okay, very good. With those conditions. Yes. Phil.
Mm-hmm. Question, please. So do you have the, do we give them the authority to go ahead and work with private versus union? I didn't get that totally there. So if union is private less money than union?
Ms. Osmussen?
I don't know that I can answer that. What I mean is that when we bring in our experts on forest burning, which we feel we need to have on these forest prescribed burns, just due to the type of employees they are with the state, they must be paid overtime after 8 hours. And you know, at other times, like if I work overtime on the same site, I can, you know, I can flex my time or I can do something like that. But due to the type of employees there, they must be, how they're classified by the union, they must be paid overtime. And that's, having the money to pay that overtime has been a limitation into us getting these fire burns done. So I don't know that I was really comparing that to, there would be, these people that we need on these forest burns, there's no really substitute for them. These would be like our burn bosses. They would be the ones running the big engines. You know, there's really no substitute for these people. We can bring more people in and MCC to be on the line and watchers and that kind of thing, but we need these real experts that are trained for the wildfire control to be in charge of these fire burn or these forest burns. Is that?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
I didn't mean the union in general. I just meant the overtime. The overtime costs are obviously going to be more than. And the normal cost, and that's what I was getting to there. That it's cheaper to do, if it's cheaper to go private. And you're telling me that there's no private folks that are skilled enough to handle that?
Representative, one of the challenges we have specifically with prescribed burning is that by law you have to have qualified burn bosses. And there truly is a limitation on the number of private companies that have burn boss qualifications such that they can burn on state land. We do use private contractors to do burning in a number of instances, but there's less than a handful that are in the state that are qualified to do that kind of work. Specifically to the burning.
Rick, I just have a clarifying question on the motion. So we're not amending the consent because we've already passed that. This is a separate motion with the boilerplate and the language.
And the additional language that Bill read. Any further discussion on the motion to approve item 3D as indicated by Bill? And
would you like for me to read?
Please.
The motion is... Mr. Hartwell moves to approve 3D Accelerated Forest Wildlife Habitat Program contingent upon program manager filing the following item with the Lasard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council. A copy of a written communication with the MCC considering possible use of their services for restoration and enhancement work. A description of the land acquisition partial selection process. An easement stewardship plan required by laws of Minnesota, 2010, Chapter 361, Article 1, Section 2, and a signed acknowledgement that the program manager will comply with all applicable laws and statutes, including but not limited to Minnesota Statutes 2010, Section 97A.056, Subdivision 9, lands in public domain, and provision of a list of detailed parcel activity descriptions as part of the accomplishment plan for staff approval.
Further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion adopted. Thank you.
The next project on the list is the Minnesota Prairie Recovery Project. And Mr. Landler, I believe, is representing that project.
Come forward. morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the council. Thank you for having me here. Director, I'm Tom Langer. I'm the Assistant State Director for the Nature Conservancy.
Mr. Randall, would you...
If there are no further questions.
Not so fast.
Mr. Chair, in chatting with Billy yesterday, I want to make the offer that this proposal of ours has got a lot of elements. It's not just a land acquisition, it's not just a land enhancement. And I know that the project proposal is not necessarily the easiest thing to read. I developed sort of a bullet list of the elements of our proposal. And if you are willing to spend the time, I'd be delighted to go over that right now. I really feel the need to make sure everybody understands what we're proposing here, so there's no surprises or questions left in anybody's mind. So I'll throw that offer out, Mr. Chairman. I do have copies of the bullet.
That's a good idea. Somebody have staff pass that out. That's great.
And while that's happening, I would just like to say that the staff analysis of this particular project, the issue that came up was our lands acquired without our Heritage Fund dollars, held by the Nature Conservancy and scheduled to be restored without our Heritage Fund dollars. Are they in a permanent publicly protected status as required by law?
So, Mr. Chair, at that point, I think when the question came up, it was obviously that, well, maybe some people didn't realize that we're proposing to acquire and hold lands in by the Nature Conservancy, recognizing there's always this state reversionary language that allows the state to secure these bad things that we do something wrong. But that's such a basic element of the proposal, and I thought maybe it's important to spend a little bit of time just to go through the elements of the proposal so that everybody does understand if there are any questions that would be delighted to answer. So, Mr. Chair, with the indulgence, I'll quickly run through this bulleted list. And I want to start out, you know, by prefacing this a little bit. You know, as the conservation community is thinking about projects and writing proposals, you know, what we're asking ourselves is, what do we want the state to look like in 2034? You know, what is it you all want? What is it the citizens of Minnesota want? And start our proposals with sort of the end in mind. So to that point, if you look at the ultimate goals that I've suggested there, you know, we're going through a planning process right now a strategic planning process with multiple partners, but for the purpose of, you know, envisioning what our 25-year goal is, I think it's fair to say that we want to protect the remaining unprotected prairie acres. There's about 90,000 to 100,000 unprotected prairie acres. And because there's pressure on those acres right now to be converted, we'd like to see that done in a short amount of time. So I'm proposing 90,000 acres over 15 years, which is 6,000 acres a year. All of the relevant plans that relate to prairies, pheasant plan and duck plan, talk about restoring X number of acres of additional grass. And we're proposing in this that our ultimate goal ought to be at least 500,000 acres of additional grassland protected. Of course, we have that right now with CRP, and one of the concerns is that we could lose CRP and we have no permanent protection. So we think that one of the additional elements that we want to see in 25 years is the protection of perhaps an additional 800,000 acres of grassland as part of that component that's already out there with WMAs and WPAs. But further, as has been mentioned a couple times here already, if we don't adequately manage that land through restoration enhancement, we're going to have WMAs and WPAs that aren't providing the benefits there. So we also suggest that we need to look at capacity among the conservation community, the agencies and organizations combined, of managing up to 400,000 acres a year, whether it's prescribed fire or invasive species control or woody brush control or whatever it might be. That's one of the frequent complaints we hear, is that the state has these lands, can't manage them. We want to help set up an infrastructure that in 25 years we'll be able to handle that. So that's just kind of the setting. And what I would encourage you to think of is, when you look at this proposal, this is really, you know, our attempt at saying, here's the first step in that 25-year process. And so the objectives are established as a sort of a nested set of objectives within a larger framework. So what we're proposing in this proposal, what you're looking at the accomplishment plan for, is the protection of up to 1,000 acres of primarily prairie land. I say primarily prairie land because oftentimes when you buy an individual tract, there is cropland associated with it. We buy on the ownership, not necessarily on the habitat type. Part of that 1,000 acres could be up to 250 acres of cropland, and that is that second bullet. So we're proposing to acquire 1,000 acres. 250 acres of it will be needing restoration. The third key element here is the enhancement of up to 8,000 acres, primarily of wildlife management area. We look at the ownership of grass, the public ownership of grass in the state, the protected status of grass in the state as being, you know, we like to look at it without the silos of our organizations. And we acknowledge that, you know, a nature conservancy grassland or a scientific natural area grassland that's adjacent to the WMA grassland, they all benefit if they're all managed well. So we're looking at this as a way to start thinking about how to comprehensively manage the public investment in grassland. And really, as it suggests in that fourth objective there, is start thinking about a new model for grassland management. We've got a lot of good tools out there, but they've all been developed sort of in isolation without a sense of how they can work collaboratively or without a sense of, well, what are we ultimately going to, what's going to be our end point? So quickly then, the elements of the proposal, we'll select two focus areas where there are concentrations of prairies. We will employ two prairie managers, ideally who will sit in DNR offices so that they can coordinate closely with DNR on managing lands within those landscapes. They'll work to do additional conservation on public lands, look to find those protection opportunities on some private lands. We will bring additional capacity for prescribed fire. You've heard about that a couple of times already. We're open to how that looks. You know, one of the things that I became aware of after we wrote this, a lot of DNR wildlife managers, for instance, in the western part of the state, have burn boss certification, which is really the bottleneck, it's really the limiting factor. But they don't have the seasonal staff to come and help them for the 10 weeks a year they can burn. So they round up as many of their DNR colleagues as they can because it's a very limiting factor for DNR to actually do prescribed fire because they have to rely primarily on their own internal capacity. So if we can give them bodies, seasonal bodies, whether they're MCC or otherwise, that will help that bottleneck. We do have specifically listed here MCC as a contractor and had some verbal discussions over at MCC about what they might do. So, again, the prairie managers will work primarily on public lands to enhance those public lands. They're working to develop collaboratives with grazers, private grazers. We want to bring grazing to the table as a use of, as a conservation tool, because it is an effective way to do grassland management. It's also an effective way to generate income, and we're proposing to generate income. The 1,000 acres that TNC will be acquiring and holding will generate income from grazing leases that we will hold in a discrete account. We'll use that funding that is held in that account to pay for the taxes, the property taxes that would be otherwise lost if it was taken off the tax rolls, and for any management expenses that the additional costs will cover. One point of consideration here is typically when you look at conservation grazing, you're looking at the current rental rates for grazing, we're probably looking in the range of $10 to $20 an acre of income. It's not $150 an acre you might get off a crop lease. It's a much more modest amount. So if you're thinking about how that account grows and what's in it, it's going to be tight to make payment on taxes and management expenses, and it's not going to be a fund that's going to be growing over time. But we believe it's an appropriate way, especially when you're dealing with questions about how to pay for long-term management, to think about how can we use these lands to help pay for long-term management. I think initially this is going to be, well, not just initially, for long-term, this is going to be a huge amount of time to get this done right. We're proposing in here to have half-time coordinator to get this kicked off. And the final bullets, F and G, again, just talking about those 1,000 acres that we're proposing to acquire. Of course, the constitutional requirement is that these lands be open to public access for hunting and fishing. Of course, that's going to be the case. Obviously, we recognize that there's a little challenge with having grazing and having public access, but we think by the timing of the hunting season and so on, we can deal with some of those issues. And then just, you know, one of our desires, one of our goals is to also look at how we're going to bring additional funds to do this work, because there are other fund sources out there, federal and other state sources that we can bring to the table as well to help make this work. But again, one step, and you have an RFP out there right now. I'm busily working on phase two of virtually a similar thing to look at expanding this prairie management concept across western Minnesota. And one last point, if I could, Mr. Chair, when I say prairies, I recognize that people sometimes get hung up on looking, maybe I'm just talking about native prairie grasslands. When I say prairies, I mean that part of the state that historically has grown grasslands and all of the relevant habitats in there. So CRP land, restored grasslands under WRP or PREP, riverine wetland systems, and everything that might otherwise be contained in the prairie landscape. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for your indulgence on that. I'd be delighted to answer any questions.
Thank you, Tom. That's real helpful. I'm looking at page 7 of your proposal, and you have in the enhancement, you have in June of 2011, 2,500 acres of prescribed fire as an enhancement activity, and then in June of 12, 4,500. You mentioned that the work will be primarily on WMA lands. What other lands would they be on?
Mr. Chair and Council members, ideally WPAs as well, and the 1,000 acres that we're acquiring with the Outdoor Heritage Fund money.
Any other comments? Ryan.
Mr. Chairman, Tom, you talked about the income you're generating and it'll be held in a discrete account. Is that going to be available for review for council, for other public bodies that are partnering? I mean, I guess I don't have a major problem with you guys generating account or generating income off these properties, especially with grazing being a beneficial management tool. But since it's in large part being generated because of public investment through the council and through our funds, I'd like to make sure that those monies are being returned, and I'd like to know how the public's going to see that those privately held funds are being used to public benefit. So can you fill me in on that? Is there in council members, is that something perhaps we should make as part of the contingency, requiring annual accounting of those funds and how they're spent?
So Mr. Landon, before you respond, Bill.
Recently distributed to all members a motion to approve this project, and one of the contingencies in that motion is to provide semi-annual income and expenditure statements in the form required by the council. So I think we've anticipated this as an issue, and if this motion is approved, there'll be a provision for them to send us on a six-month basis a description of their income and how they use it.
Mr. Chairman, Ryan, absolutely, I understand this is going to be one of those tough questions, and I'm absolutely open to alternatives. Obviously, you know that at the Capitol, there's been discussion about setting up management accounts, so the idea is out there that we start looking at how to pay for long-term management, and we're proposing this as a way to start the process. We do quarterly statements, and we have an extraordinary accounting system, so any product that you want to see, we can provide. I'd also entertain the notion that there is some way to set it up in a state system that, still easily facilitates that transfer of funds back and forth. I'm wide open to that as well. I think the concept is important, and that is let us use these lands to generate some income, hold that money in a pot specifically for doing that, those enhancement practices, and then be able to draw on it. So I'm wide open to options about how that might look.
Well, I've never seen a state system where it makes money moving back and forth easy. So I don't know that.
You can see the blood dripping out of the mouth and coming on my tongue as I was saying that.
This is a big vision, big picture project. And, I mean, this is probably more so than any other project that's been proposed. I mean, this is looking at a really big scale, wholesale, trying to address a whole landscape. And I commend you on that. I'm curious how the other partners that are also working in the same landscape, are cooperating, or potentially this could be the prairie project that we work on, because you are working on public and private lands. So long term, I'd like to know how that those potential partnerships are working, public and private.
Mr. Chairman, Ryan, thank you for the question. Thank you for the acknowledgement. We because we don't have a contact, right, we can't go too far with making any formal arrangements. So we've had a lot of discussions with our DNR counterparts. We have field offices. We have 7 field offices in the state, and one of those is in Kitson County, one of those is in Painesville, and we work very closely with the DNR offices. We've already had sort of informal discussions with those DNR offices about the proposal. The DNR offices are, the people in those offices are very, very excited about this project because they, you know, they understand that there's, you know, they're understaffed, they're in hiring freeze right now. They understand that there are limitations of what they can do as an agency. I think everybody looks at the landscape and says, you know, it's not likely that we're going to grow agencies, whether local, state, or federal, to handle the additional volume of activities that could be funded with the Outdoor Heritage Fund. We have to look at new models. So I think, you know, this idea of trying to bring in help to cross these silos, you know, across state and federal land ownerships, for instance, and the ability to bring in not only MCC, but try to grow the private sector side of the equation as well, is a way to help the DNR managers with problems that they have realized for many, many years. And the Fish and Wildlife Service managers, you know, all of them right now would love to do 2, 3, 4 times as much burning, for instance, as they do right now. I'm estimating we burn maybe 60 to 80,000 acres a year collectively in the state. And the state owns 1.4 million acres of WMA. Not all that's in Fulton Prairie, of course, but they could easily do 3 to 4 times that amount of burning if they had the capacity to do it. And then you wouldn't be hearing these complaints about, well, DNR can't manage land they have right now. So we're really trying to work collaboratively. The DNR managers are very receptive because they see this as an asset and the outcomes they want to see as well.
One of the issues that, you know, the uniqueness of this project is the fact that TNC will be holding land. Greg, I want to put you on the spot. Just talk about the protections that are in law to address this question of land that remains in the intended use and protections and management that it has intended to be through this appropriation over time. Can you talk about what's currently in statute, the Constitution, to address that issue?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you have a sheet in your, should be in your packet that's, it says Program 2F, Minnesota Prairie Recovery Project, the top issue, staff examination. Working with Mr. Becker and Ms. Koop on this issue, you can see it basically says in there what the conditions are. Because basically, you have a provision that passed in the law. It was in this year's law and last year's. But it says, except as otherwise provided in the section, all restoration enhancement projects must be on land that's permanently protected by a conservation easement or public ownership or in public water or in public waters. But the exception is that there are a couple places where you in the law where you allow for restoration and enhancement activities on projects that were acquired with money from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. You can see that this project is for acquiring interest and then also for restoring and enhancing prairies. So in that case where they've acquired the land with the Outdoor Heritage Fund, then they can go ahead and provide restoration enhancement on there. And that land is protected. I mean, you do have, if you look at it, if you've got that sheet in front of you, you do. It does say that they have to record along with the conveyance, where the conveyance of the interest is filed, saying that this interest in real property shall be administered in accordance with the terms, conditions, and purposes of the grant agreement controlling the acquisition of the property. The interest in real property or any portion of the interest shall not be sold, transferred, pledged, or otherwise disposed of or further encumbered without obtaining prior written approval of Osar Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council or a successor. So you do have a provision in law that says that that you can that they can't do anything with the land prior without your approval. And then also there's another provision in there that's not stated here, but it says that the land converts to the state if you don't follow the contract, you don't follow the accomplishment plan, or if the land is restricted such that it doesn't fulfill its original purpose. So you do have there's quite a bit of protection here, and I think Mr. Becker has put together a motion to approve this that includes some of those conditions. The one thing I will call attention to, though, getting at the issue with Mr. Landwehr was talking about, in his bulleted list there are a couple of issues that would be of concern without the way the motion is. On a couple of them, if you look at 2C,
it says that they're going to do this on public and other protected conservation land. It's important to note that those protected conservation lands would have to be subject to an easement or public or other or some other type of protection like that. They'd have to be a permanent easement. And then I also on 3B, item number, looks like Roman numeral 6, it says on public and selected private lands. I'm a little concerned about the selected private lands unless they are subject to an easement. But when you get, there's a motion, again, that Mr. Becker and staff from the council put together, I think that takes care of that. Because I think the only areas that they should be able to provide any enhancement or restoration on is either land that's been acquired with the Elkhart Heritage Fund, or then would be subject to the general provision that says it has to be protected by a permanent conservation easement, public ownership, or in public waters. Those would be the only, and I think that's in the motion that Mr. Becker put together. So,
and that was the purpose of my question about the other lands beyond WMAs, to make sure that those are permanently protected either through public ownership or permanent easement.
And the only other private land I can think of that might be something you would want to think about would be Prairie Bank lands, subject to a state easement, or WRP, Rim WRP lands, where it might make sense. And I think, frankly, in the time frame we've got here with this proposal, we're going to be, you know, working primarily on public lands. We're not going to be able to take on anything else. But I think in the long term, again, with the notion of eliminating silos, you know, those protected private lands are in need of management and can provide benefits as well.
Right. I think, yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to clarify again that if, as long as the motion is passed, that's taken care of in the motion.
Right.
Eric, I'd like to move approval of the Prairie Recovery Project.
Okay. So we have a motion to approve the Minnesota Prairie Recovery Program with the motion that's before you with the four itemized requirements. Jim.
I just had one question, Tom, just so I have this right in my own mind. The 1,000 acres that you're going to protect, so the Conservancy is going to buy this in fee title, and then we put up some kind of a conservation easement on that property?
Mr. Lambert?
Chair, Jim, the first part of that is correct. We would buy that. Now, I think what the discussion has been is there anything gained by putting an easement on it? I think the protection for the state is in the grant agreement, the contract that we signed, and the statutory provisions that already say, you know, if we ever do anything contrary to the work plan, then the thing reverts to the state. So that there's reversionary language is in the statute right now. It's frankly much stronger than an easement. An easement just says you can or can't do certain things. Reversionary language says if you screw up, you lose it. And that's what you have right now is a version of that.
But still, if you own the land, the Nature Conservancy owns the land without an easement on it, you can do basically whatever you want.
Not subject to, because this is actually a deed, it's not a deed restriction, it's recorded with the deed. It goes with the land. We can't, it stays with the land forever. So forever, as long as the Nature Conservancy holds this land, we will be subject to the provisions of the grant agreement and the work plan that you've approved. That says it can only be used for these purposes, and it should we use it for anything else, or try to sell it, or do anything else with it, then it either reverts to the state, or we're obligated to replace an equal value. So it's stronger than an easement, we just say you can't do this, or you're subject to a suit.
Okay. So, and do you see these parcels being? Is it one parcel? Are they going to be parcels in close proximity, or are they going to be spread all over? Or how are these parcels going to be selected?
Mr. Chair, I did give Heather a copy of our parcel selection criteria. There's a number of things we're looking at. I mean, we're focusing for the first year on five focus areas that have been identified by the Department of Natural Resources having high concentrations of prairie. We're looking for lands that are within those five focus areas. We're looking for lands that are predominantly native prairie. We're looking for lands that have grazing potential because we want to use these as part of that demonstration. Ideally, the department has to check off on all of our acquisitions, and we're going to ask them to check off with the notion that, you know, ultimately this might, would this be suitable for WMA to be transferred back to the state? So we're looking at a number of elements to suggest what would make the highest priority for protection in under this proposal.
And then just one other question. So as this project continues to move on, Tom, and you continue to acquire this land, I mean, do you foresee the Conservancy continually to, you know, acquiring this land and keeping this land, or do you see this land moving on as time goes by, or what do you see long term with this land?
Mr. Chair, I'm wide open to that. One of the issues that I've heard time and again is, well, if the department owns it, then you're subject to the PILT, you're subject to the local government approval, you're subject to, you know, the additional burden to the department. So I don't want to go in presuming that when we acquire a piece of land, the department will ultimately hold it. So there are some pieces of land that I would argue the Nature Conservancy would be willing to hold indefinitely. In fact, we're taking on all of these with the notion that we would hold them indefinitely because they are so valuable from the standpoint of their, you know, their natural values. But I'd love to have a policy discussion about what makes more sense after 10, 15, 20 years. Do we convey to the state? You know, does it become WMA or some other holding, or, you know, what is the preferred endpoint? At this point, you know, we do own 70,000 acres in the state that was privately acquired, so we have the capacity to hold a large chunk of land. I don't think that I want to tell you today that we want to take on 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 acres of prairie and hold it in perpetuity. I think that, you know, there are other costs that aren't covered by the Outdoor Heritage Fund that we incur that we'd not be able to sustain. So I wish I had a better answer. I'd say at this point in time, what we're proposing under here, we'd be willing to hold those lands indefinitely, and I suspect we'd say that for a couple more phases, but I don't know that I could say that, you know, for 25 years. And I'm not, you know, I think this is one of the policy questions I'd love to hear an issue on, or a discussion on, because I don't know what is the best answer to that. I think the tools we've got are good, but I'm not sure that the tools we've got out there right now are good enough to handle an additional 100,000 acres of protected prairie.
Right. I'm curious about the property tax impacts for local governments. We're requiring in the motion that you pay all full property taxes that you own. Now, if we don't place an easement on a piece of property, and let's say it's high-quality prairie grasslands that you restore that's right next to beetland, so it's high-value agricultural land, my understanding would be that it would be taxed at the highest and best use, which would be as agricultural land, which would have a significant impact. I mean, that's a fairly valuable piece of property. Now, with a easement on it, maybe I misunderstand how the local property tax works, but the highest and best use would then not be as ag land, but as grassland, wasteland, or however it's classified in whatever county it is. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, Ryan, in most places, the county is assessed based on the current use of the land.
Okay.
You know, it's a challengeable assumption that the highest and best use would be something else. And, you know, the good, bad, or different, most of the prairie that's out there is either too wet, too rocky, too steep, too sandy, or too something, and it's never going to be, you know, valuable cropland.
I think just on that point, Ryan, if you pull the county assessors, you'd find they do everything.
Right.
Some would raise the value, and some would lower the value, some wouldn't change the value. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Scott.
I have a question for Mr. Landwehr, and you can clarify and can I ask that?
I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
Are you there? Can you clarify, Mr. Landwehr, are all lands owned by the Nature Conservancy open to hunting, fishing, and taking a game in open season?
Mr. Landwehr?
Mr. Chair, Scott, no, they're not. We own approximately 70,000 acres in the state, and I have not done an analysis lately, but I think 90% of the land is open to hunting.
Did you hear that, Scott?
I did not. Louder?
I'm sorry.
Could you repeat it? And just
I'm sorry, Scott. We own about 70,000 acres in Minnesota, and somewhere in the range of 90% of that is open to hunting. Some lands are not open to hunting.
Would these lands acquired in this proposal be open to hunting?
Scott, absolutely. It's required by the Constitution, and, you know, we're absolutely going to abide by all constitutional and statutory requirements.
So Greg, just on that point, if there was a proposed change in recreational access, what would have to happen?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you would have to have a law that would state that, because it is, you know, as the Constitution states, it's open to the public taking of game and fish during the open season, unless otherwise prescribed by law. So you would have to have a law that said that they would close these down. Otherwise, they have to keep them open to hunting and fishing.
Thank you.
Bill, can you restate the motion? We do have a motion on the table to approve the work plan subject to some provisions.
And I would like to add, Mr. Chair, that copies of the motion are on the table up above. All the members have it. It is the motion that is titled Motion to Approve Prairie Recovery Project. And it says, Councilor Nelson moved to approve 2F, the Minnesota Prairie Recovery Program, contingent upon submission to the LaSalle Sands Outdoor Heritage Council of a revised accomplishment plan, one, pledging to provide semiannual income and expenditure statements to the LaSalle Sands Outdoor Heritage Council in a form prescribed by the council, two, confirming that the Nature Conservancy will pay the property taxes on all land acquired with Outdoor Heritage Fund dollars appropriated in laws of Minnesota 2010, Chapter 361, Article 1, Section 2, Subdivision 2F. And three, acknowledging that restoration and enhancement will be limited to land permanently protected by a conservation easement or public ownership or in public waters as defined in Minnesota Statutes 103G.005, Subdivision 15, or interest in land acquired using funds appropriated in laws of Minnesota, Chapter 2010, Chapter 361, Article 1, Section 2, Subdivision 2F, and contingent upon program managers filing the following items with the LaSalle Sands Outdoor Heritage Council. And that should be revised to contingent upon the program filing the following items with the LaSalle Sands Outdoor Heritage Council. One, a copy of written communication with the MCC considering possible use of their services for restoration and enhancement work. Two, a description of the land acquisition parcel selection process. Three, an easement stewardship plan required by laws of Minnesota, Chapter 2010, or Minnesota 2010, Chapter 361, Article 1, Section 2. And a signed acknowledgement that the program manager will comply with all acceptable laws and statutes, including but not limited to Minnesota Statutes 2010, Section 978.056, Subdivision 9. Title lands in public domain.
Further discussion on the motion? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the council, thank you all very much. It's very exciting and delighted to have an opportunity to get you all to look at some of these sites in the near future.
Look forward to it. Thank you. Bill, you did this fall.
Josh Stevenson, Chris Larson, Critical Shoreline Protection Program. The issue here was the high cost of easement stewardship and personnel relative to other easement programs. Chris?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, good morning. Chris Larson, Executive Director with the Minnesota Land Trust. I appreciate an opportunity to inform you and give you a little bit more background on our easement stewardship programs. I think it's really important going forward that you understand both what our program contains and also how we fund it. And I won't go into great detail on all of that, but I did provide a handout which you should have both with a cover letter to Mr. Becker as well as other information, both our easement stewardship plan for this particular program as well as information about how we calculate stewardship costs and then a formula or a worksheet that describes that in more detail. Suffice it to say, to be a qualified conservation organization according to the IRS, we need to show two things. One is the resources to defend our easements into the future, and the other is the commitment to do so. And also, as an accredited land trust nationally, we also have to show that we have funds sufficient to cover our easement stewardship program and stewardship needs. And so both by law and by policy, we have to have sufficient stewardship resources. And so the question is, well, what does that mean and how do we derive that? That's really what I wanted to provide for you in a handout, was showing you what easement stewardship covers. A lot of people assume immediately that just means monitoring, but really is much more than that. It includes monitoring, certainly, and we monitor annually, so we are out there on properties every year. But it also includes easement management in terms of questions that come up, approvals, queries, landowner issues, adjacent landowner issues that come up quite frequently, and then, of course, legal defense if necessary. So there's a whole host of activities that go on underneath our easement stewardship program. And the question then is, well, how do we fund those? What is the sufficient way to do that? And About a dozen years ago or so, our board set up an easement stewardship enforcement fund, which is a separate fund from our operating fund, which essentially covers all of that activity. And the way we determine how much is appropriate given any any specific project, that's what the information that I provided you there with explains, and that's a formula that we go through on every project that looks at all of the variables on that particular project to say, what are we going to need to go ahead and monitor, how far is it, what are the terms of that easement, how large is it, are there specific management requirements that are on a particular project, and a whole host of other assumptions that goes into that. So we look at this individually on any given project to see what those stewardship requirements are, and that tells us what we need on an annual basis to be able to manage and monitor and maintain that conservation easement. And then that amount, we figure out what we need in a one-time contribution to draw essentially 5% a year to be able to cover those costs. So on a typical project, and typical for us means it's about 100 miles from one of our offices, there is no residence associated with that, it's a no-build easement, it's about 100 acres in size. So that's a typical, although I should note that our easements vary all over the map, but that's kind of a typical one. We figured that one-time contribution right now is at about $15,000 that is required to give us the annual income we need to be able to monitor and manage that conservation easement. And so that's what we have figured out and kind of plugged into all of our proposals when it comes to whether it's Lazard Sam's recommendation or through the LCCMR. It's the same formula we go through on any project, regardless of funding source, that gives us that annual income that's sufficient to cover our needs. And that funding, then again, we put into our stewardship enforcement fund, which we draw from annually, and we have a board finance committee that oversees that, and of course our annual audit and our 990 is reflective of the activity from that. And we have historically, through the LCCMR for the past 8 years, had a whole system in place of checks and balances to make sure that we notify LCCMR and DNR when we actually need to draw funds and why we need to do that. We show when the funds are deposited into our account. We have an annual reporting on the conservation easement activity for any easement funded through the LCCMR through the state. And then we provide a copy of our 990 and audit as well so they can staff can review that to make sure that our funds are being managed appropriately. So there's a whole system of checks and balances we've worked out, and I do have a letter that has gone, from about 8 years ago, and it's been updated since then to describe that relationship with the LCCMR. And in talking with Mr. Becker, we assumed we'd have some similar arrangement with the Lazard Sam's Epcot Heritage Council.
Bill, thank you.
And in addition to that, I want to note that Michelle Gross, who does the reimbursements for DNR, is in the audience. I want to hear this. DNR needs to be comfortable with this analysis of the stewardship costs as well. I know that previously it's been reviewed by the Finance Division and DNR. The department needs to make a decision on whether it needs to be re-reviewed as time goes by. Things are updated. I think it might be a good thing to take another look at it. And it's part and parcel of the department's fiduciary responsibility to ensure that the disbursements that they make are ones that are in keeping with the public good.
Chris, I have a question. So I'm looking at the amount for easement stewardship, and I understand the calculus that went behind it. It's about 23%, according to my calculator, of the total appropriation is for create a corpus for ongoing easement stewardship. And I'm looking at the other project, which is Project 5E, that you are a partner with, which is the Valley Creek Protection Partnership. And there's only $12,000 going to the Minnesota Land Trust in that one. Mm-hmm. Can you help me understand the disparity between?
Sure.
I mean, that's a pretty big range. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, members, I think it's important, and that's why I wanted to preface this with the calculus or with that sheet, because you can see that we do this on each individual project. And for the Critical Shoreline Habitat project, we essentially had to forecast which projects we were going to work on. And so we figured that we were going to do 11 projects, and we factored that in at approximately $17,000 per project. So that gets to the total that you see under the proposal. The Valley Creek, we knew specifically which project we were looking at there, and it was one conservation easement. And that particular easement is close to the metro, it's a no-build, and it's also going to be part of a complex that is going to be managed by the Bellwind Conservancy. and it's a part of a complex where we hold other easements right in that area. So we went through that calculus and said it's not going to be as much because of all the variables that go into that particular project. Therefore, we shouldn't ask for as much money. It really is a lower amount that we need to manage that particular easement. The critical shoreline easements, because we don't know exactly which ones those are out of our list, and we'll know that as soon as we're able to begin work on the project, that we needed to forecast a sufficient amount to cover that, knowing that we have a number, again, hopefully 11 or 12 projects that would get done under that particular project.
David?
Yeah, I'd just like to provide a little context on this issue, because it is an important one, and I certainly think having the DNR take a look at it to make sure it makes sense is good, but there is a huge problem in the DNR in this state, but in land trusts around the country, not having adequate resources to do what is the gold standard in terms of easement stewardship, which is annual monitoring. If you're not out on the land every year to see what's going on, things happen. And once you've got a forest cut down, a house built, the cost of fixing that is huge. And annual monitoring is what is the standard for land trusts around the country. Accreditation, which the Minnesota Land Trust has achieved with the Land Trust Accreditation Commission, requires annual monitoring. You can't be accredited if you don't do it. So they are in compliance with the national guidelines, and the DNR's conversation earlier today about natural resource land pointing out that the DNR has a ways to go and that the LCCMR has helped start them. I will tell you, they are a huge distance from knowing what's going on and monitoring their easements appropriately. And I'd hate to see, whether it's the land trust or anybody else that we fund, get behind and not be able to protect the property that you're putting out money to protect.
Any further questions or comments of Mr. Larson regarding this program appropriation? Seeing none, Bill is crafting a motion for this.
Aren't you craft the maker of the motion?
And the maker of the motion.
I will, depending on what the motion really says, I'm happy to make the motion. I support this program.
I'll give you a start. And what we're working off of is the consent list motion. And it says David Hartwell moves to approve the accomplishment plan for 3A Critical Shoreline Habitat Protection Program, contingent upon the program manager filing the following items with Lasard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council. 1, a copy of the written communication with the MCC considering possible use of their services for restoration and enhancement work. 2, a description of the land acquisition parcel selection process. 3, an easement stewardship plan, if required by laws of Minnesota 2010, Chapter 361, Article 1, Section 2. 4, a signed acknowledgement that the program manager will comply with all applicable laws and statutes, including but not limited to Minnesota Statutes 2010, Section 97A.056, Subdivision 9, Land and Public Domain. And 5, a copy of the signed agreement with the DNR setting the amounts to be paid MLT for stewardship.
I'm happy to make that motion. So motion is on the floor, as read by Mr. Becker. Any further discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. Look forward to starting the project.
Josh Stevenson, 3D, Protect Key Industrial Forest Land Tracts in Central Minnesota. The issue there was the need to demonstrate how these parcels protect, restore, and enhance.
Stevenson, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the council. I do have a few statements to make, if I may, in regards to that subject. To start out, For those who are not aware, the corridor that runs between the Brainerd Lakes area and Walker is one of the highest growing areas in the state of Minnesota population-wise. It seems more and more people are either moving to our area permanently for retirement or they're purchasing property in our area to recreate on. We are seeing a significant increase in people on our resource, and our biggest resource that we have in our county is our public land. The proposal that I have in front of the council is to address the biggest issue that we have going on right now, which is the loss of our private industrial forest lands. One of the things that we are seeing with this is when these tracts are sold to private ownership, a lot of times they are intermixed with our public lands. They touch or are surrounded by existing private property. When they are sold, they often cut off access to existing public land, as well as limit our ability to continue to manage existing public land because of the presence of houses, developed roads, and structures on those properties. Why these are critical to us, again, we would like, right now, the historic use of these private industrial lands is they are managing lands in a similar manner to what we manage ours. So we have some cross-management activities going on in regards to prescribed burns, plantings. We're able to manage large, contiguous acres of pine so we can get the same age class, bud capping activities, site prep activities. A lot of times we'll hire a crew that's planting trees for us that happens to have the same contract with the company that owns the land next door. There's cost savings for both of us. Unfortunately, for some of our industrial landholders, they're running into a situation where they have no choice but to divest themselves of this property. And that's where we would like to step in as a neighbor and pick up the tracts of land and continue to manage them in the manner that they have been.
Questions? From Mr. Stevenson. Rick?
Mr. Stevenson, my question's on the 40 in the middle of the public land and then the 160 in the middle.
So what page, Rick, are you looking at?
Page 8 and page 10 on the map. Okay. And these were raised in the committee process as questions on, and I think staff may have looked up the partway law requirements if there was a need. And the narrative had talked about the purchase of adjacent land to allow access for management, whereas these are private tracts in the middle of public land, not adjacent. And so maybe if you could explain the why we need to purchase those two tracks.
Mr. Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. I believe that the tract on page 8, or if you're referring to the 120-acre tract on Farnham Lake.
No, that's page 9.
No, it's a 40-acre tract. Page 8.
Okay, the 40, this is the 40 or the 41-acre?
40.
I apologize. My page numbers must be different from the ones that you're looking at.
Section 16.
That particular track in Section 16 has actually been replaced with another track. This is an older accomplishment plan. The 40 in the middle of Section 16 has actually been replaced with another 40 that's adjacent to public land in Township 13930. It was brought to our attention about 3 weeks ago that the state of Minnesota had actually offered Potlatch a purchase agreement on that tract to obtain it. So therefore, we removed it from our list and substituted it with another 40 in Powers Township.
I move to table this until the next meeting.
So we have a motion on the table to table this particular accomplishment plan until the August meeting, pending further description of the proposed tracts to be protected in future. So further discussion on the motion.
I'm okay with the motion, but now that brings up a whole new question on that specific tract. Is that county land that surrounds it?
Mr. Chairman, it is not. It's actually the state of Minnesota land that surrounds it.
The shading's hard to tell. So the state's buying an in-holding with this land. Okay. Now I'm okay.
Further discussion of the bill.
Just one question. Maybe you can bring this to the next one. With the purchasing and then putting it into trust, obviously there's going to be some revenue situations there that are lost to counties and townships. Who is buying up most of the land in that particular area? Is that a fair question, or over the last 10 years?
Mr. Chairman, the majority of the land that's being purchased in this area is actually being purchased by private landholders. So it varies. Most of them are, the reason that these are being so highly sought after is, quite frankly, the county and the state of Minnesota is a very good neighbor to have. There's no, besides the random hunter in the fall, basically you have no neighbor. And if you also have no property line, for that matter, when it comes to deer hunting, grouse hunting, or any other type of recreation, it's all open. That's one of the biggest issues that we're running into is people love our forested land so much, they all want their own piece adjacent or within our existing public land holdings. I hope that addresses that part of the question. The second part of the question, in regards to revenue streams, in Cass County, we have a very active and productive timber management program in which we have been very successful in supporting our own activities and continually able to distribute around $1 million a year back to the public from proceeds that we get off timber revenue. So after we cover our expenses, after we pay for site plantings, site prep, we've begun a pretty active program on aerial seeding in some of our remote areas that we're not getting to or aren't as able to get to. We are still able to give a significant amount of money of our proceeds back to the public.
Further discussion on the motion to table this particular accomplishment plan until the August meeting, pending further detail on the tracts to be protected, enhanced, and restored. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I look forward to coming back.
Josh, we'll be back in touch with you in the meantime to discuss this. The next item on the agenda is 2B, the Green Corridor Legacy Program, Brad Cobb. And Brad, we'd like you to provide an explanation of the personnel costs, and not the value added by third parties, but specifically the value that you bring to the project as we extend those personnel costs. I think the council is familiar with the value of third parties.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Brad Cobb. I'm the program manager for the Green Corridor Initiative. To answer the question regarding the cost of personnel associated to the accomplishment plan, and let me just get to that. The personnel fees associated to that will be for activities that are directly related to this appropriation and to the outcomes or accomplishments of the plan. Some of those activities would include establishing the process of lists of appraisers, going through that process of awarding a contract to appraisals, possible survey work, negotiating landowner purchase agreements, and following through on the process by which tracts of land would be evaluated and subsequently approved or reviewed by the Department of Natural Resources. As a pretty broad general statement, that activity we calculate at about 100 to 150 hours per project, give or take. Sometimes there's more complexity to one particular tract or negotiations with the landowner, but that would probably be an average.
Mr. Cobb, in being reimbursed by DNR, you will be required to provide record to substantiate the time and what it was spent on?
Absolutely, and I believe there's actually a guideline already established by the state that was actually facilitated through LCCMR activities that I would think would be the template or the protocol by which we would follow as well.
Further questions on this particular accomplishment plan? I guess just in general, Mr. Cobb, for the five projects that you're proposing, just give us a sense of how far down the road you are in each of these. Are they all at the same level of advancement in terms of acquiring these, or does it vary quite a bit?
We have evaluated these properties and have contacted the landowners about their potential willingness, but until we have an accomplishment plan that's been approved and when the state funds are actually appropriated or when they're legally, then we will actually begin the serious work of doing the final negotiations, going through the process of DNR acceptance, yes. I do have a handout here. I prepared to talk about the general question about value added to third parties. I would be more than happy to leave that or... Should I save it?
I'd say you can leave it with staff. That would be helpful.
Okay.
Third question.
Yeah, it's a not very significant here, but I look on page 6 and I see under personnel $6,000 for fiscal manager and $31,000 for program manager. And I mean, on the next page, where the the personnel on page 5, $29,000 plus the $2,000, that gives me $31,000 acknowledged under personnel there. But I go to the next page, and I've got an extra $6,000. And I'm wondering, is that just a computational error? Did you leave something out?
Mr. Chair,
yeah, Bill.
I would point out that he's actually listed the fiscal agent under additional budget items on page 5 at the bottom of the budget.
Or the middle of the budget, would be a better way.
Underneath the first item, underneath additional budget items.
Okay. All right. I see.
Further questions for Mr. Cox? Bill.
Mr. Chair, if we could find a maker of a motion, I have a motion.
Yeah. Someone would be willing to entertain a motion? Bill Ingebretson.
Councilor Ingebretson moves to approve 2B of Green Corridor Legacy Program contingent upon the program manager filing final items with the assigned Sand Outdoor Heritage Council. A copy of the written communication with MCC, a description of the land acquisition partial selection process, an easement stewardship plan as required by Minnesota Law 2010, Chapter 361, Article 1, Section 2, and a signed acknowledgement that the program manager will comply with all applicable laws and statutes, including but not limited to new sub-statutes 2010, Section 97A.056, Subdivision 9, lands in public domain.
We have a motion on the table. Further discussion on that motion to approve Program 2B, the Green Corridor Legacy Program. There is no further discussion. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion adopted. Thank you.
Thank you, Council, and we look forward to your regional visit to Southwest Minnesota tomorrow.
The next on the list is the 5E, Dakota County Riparian Intellectual Protection and Restoration. Al Singer is the program manager. The issue here was the personnel table without alignment with the budget table. And I'm going to pass out a motion that solves that problem.
Well, he's passing that out. Good morning, Mr. Singer.
Good morning, Chairman.
So if we have a motion that fixes it, why spend much time on this? It's up to you.
I have another question.
Yes.
Rick.
Al, on page 3, in that first paragraph on the top, it has some dates that I'm a little confused about. It talks about Dakota County Commissioners approved submission of the proposal on October 20th, 2010.
29.
And then it has the township officer meeting. So, and I've been to those meetings. So I'm just wondering, have you had that meeting, and what's the outcome with that action.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, we did conduct an overview of the project with the township officers in March, and they're very supportive of the concept.
So I would make this motion. We approve 5B Dakota County Riparian and Lakeshore Protection and Restoration Program contingent upon submission to the Sarsam's Outdoor Heritage Council of a revised accomplishment plan showing $140,000 budgeted for personnel and zero budgeted for contracts and contingent upon program managers filling the following items to the Outdoor Heritage Council 1, 2, 3, 4, which we approved before.
We have a motion on the table to approve the accomplishment plan as proposed. Further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion adopted. Thank you.
Member,
that includes all of the accomplishment plans, sans the DNR pass-through administration, which we will take up at our August 16th meeting. Members, at this point, motion to adjourn, and then we will move on to our field tour part of the meeting. Motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Opposed? We are adjourned. Thank you very much. Instruction, Heather and Sandy. Instructions for council members.
The bus is going to be in that round area between the DOT and the state office building. When you go to our office and pick up your luggage, if you could grab a box to haul to the bus, that would help me out a great deal.
Great. And the bus will be leaving at?
At noon, but we hope we can pull out before that. So